Good morning, honourable members. Welcome to the Portfolio Committee of Police. Also welcome to the IPIT delegation. There's also representatives from the Civil Secretariat, Civil Society, university lecturers and students as well. Welcome to them as well. Maybe just in terms of our program today and the program for the week, members, maybe first Friday, just to indicate that we've got a bundle of minutes to adopt on Friday and report, so it would be appreciated if members could be available from 9 in V454. I know members usually look forward to adopting minutes. That's one of the favorite tasks as being a member of this committee. So that will be Friday. In terms of today, we will first receive a briefing from IPIT with regard to the incident that happened in Gauteng 2 weeks ago that was widely publicized over the weekend, the alleged killing of a suspect by the police, and the purpose really today is to get an update on that case. We are IPIT in terms of dealing with the matter. Then IPIT will also brief us on complaints that they received during this last 2 to 3 weeks regarding flowing from the student protest countrywide, those cases, in terms of their mandates, how many cases, what is the nature of that, and so on, to get an update on that. Then we will get a briefing from the acting National Commissioner and of SAPS, General Pathani, and his team from Visible Policing, in terms of the management of the student protest countrywide. But more pertinently also, the first item from our side would be the breach of the National Key Point Parliament and the handling of that and lessons learned and what can be done to improve in terms of the situation. So we'll also go to that. I think General Mawela already arrived, and also the acting Divisional Commissioner for Policing, welcome to them. We will like to introduce them formally. So that is in the morning's program. Then we will have a briefing from Honorable Mbele of the T on his private members bill on the critical infrastructure bill. We'll also have a briefing first from Parliament's legal advisor on the process. In terms of the 201 draft report, just to indicate that the Secretariat has still got to do some further work on the draft report in terms of verifying, checking, updating. So hopefully we will be able to table next week Wednesday if they can fast track that process. So as soon as we're ready with that, that will be tabled in the committee for discussion and adoption. So that is where we are in terms of the next 2 weeks. Maybe just to also indicate that we have invited the Minister of Police to come to the committee next week to brief us on the work of the reference group. Members will remember that was an issue last year that we also picked up in our interaction, so the Minister will also come next week to deal with that issue pertinently. So we, apart from the other issues, so that will be 9 o'clock next week. So members, that is our program for the day. I will first give an opportunity for members to introduce themselves, and then we will ask the acting E, Mr. Khamaniani, also to introduce his delegation.
Dumelang bagaetsho, leina la ka ke nna Angie Molewatsi, ke leloko la committee e, ke a leboga.
Morning, my name is Tindile Molare, member of the Portfolio Committee, thank you.
Goeiemorgen, my naam is Pieter Groenewald.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, is Atelier Mbele, member of the committee. Thank you, Chairperson. Maurit Edelenhuis, DA, member of the committee.
Thank you very much. I presume the other members will join us during the course of the morning. Mr. Khamaniani, over to you.
Morning, Chairperson and honourable members. My name is Israel Khamaniani, Acting Executive Director of IPIT. I'm joined by Dr. Chris Makobodidi. He is our Parliamentary Liaison Officer, and next to me on my left, I'm joined by our Head of Health Services, Chief Director Marianne Orwashi, And just to hear, we've got Dr. Rongi Raburabu, based at our Gauteng provincial office.
Thank you very much. I think we will start with the presentation on the incident that happened in Gauteng. Maybe just to say, from the committee side, we noticed with alarm the incident. That incident went viral and is also reported worldwide. And it's a serious matter of police conduct, and as a committee are concerned about the signal it sends, so it's important that the oversight institutions that's responsible for doing oversight work with the police give us the necessary feedback, but also from the police side that it's important our management will have to take the lead and address it as a matter of urgency. But let's give first the acting lead an opportunity, and we will give members an opportunity to do that. Mr. Khaniani.
Thanks, Chairperson and honourable members. With regards to the part of the presentation, Mr. Rovira Burabu will deal with the presentation because he had a know-how as to when the matter started up until yesterday. I was interacting with him, and he even went to court during the appearance of those police officers, but will even come in during the questions and comment sessions. But I just want to start by indicating that I think the responsibility is to oversee the South African Police Services and APS members, and the IPIT Act is very clear in respect of our mandate as contained in Section 28 of the IPIT Act, and the voting obligations in respect of subs as contained in our Section 29. And as and when we go to JD, then that's where we deal with the responsibilities as far as the recommendations are concerned. So this particular matter, the critical of matter, falls within one of the IP mandates under Section 28, and it was duly reported as subs are expected to report in respect of Section 29. You will, honourable members and Chairperson, you will realize that there are two versions contained in the report. The first one, it was the first version that we got from SARS immediately after the incident happened. Then the second one, it was after we became aware of the existence of the video footage, that in legal fact it contradicted what was reported to the IT. Thanks very much. Over to you, Dr. Robert.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Just to talk about the incident happened on the 19th of October, or about 13 hours. And after the incident happened, the police has required by them, by the Act, in terms of Section 29, they reported this matter to us immediately. And our investigators attended the scene. And basically when the scene was attended, it didn't sound like there's anything wrong with the scene. It was only after the scene was attended, when we got the report, everything was okay, up until we received a footage that was coming from police themselves. They brought it to our office on the afternoon of the 20th, the following day. And when we viewed the footage, we actually saw that this was actually an execution. It was not the way it was presented to us by the duty officer at the scene. Upon seeing the video, we decided to validate and authenticate the video first as to whether this is the exact incident of what happened. And then we decided to actually look for the person who operated the video when this was taken. Unfortunately, this person were not willing to speak to our members when our members went there. We decided to then go back and consult the police with regard to that. The guy then gave us a statement to the effect that he operated. This was actually the incident happened as it was on the video. And by then we had not visited, we had not attended the postmortem, because after that the postmortem had to be attended, because normally our members attend the postmortem examination to actually marry what happened at the scene and combine it with what the evidence or the body says. And it was indeed confirmed that the video actually shows, what video shows, it's actually true, that's what the postmortem actually revealed. And then we started with the investigation thereon, and our investigation was completed just around Wednesday, and then we started looking for the members. Just to arrest them. And when we went there, the main culprit was not there when we were supposed to arrest them. That was on Thursday, last week, when we went there at night to go and effect an arrest, because this shift was working there night shift. And we immediately made recommendations, and before I speak to the recommendations, I just need to indicate the last sentence of the recommendations. There has been a typographical error. It says, in the light of the above findings, the IP recommends that no members. It actually should read, all members be charged, not no members. We made the recommendations as reflected there that this member should be charged in terms of Regulation 20. And the incident then culminated in disguise, the police officers being arrested on Monday, this Monday, and they appeared in court yesterday. And the three members, one sergeant and two constables, were charged with murder and defeating the ends of justice. And the lady member of the group was charged only with defeating the ends of justice. She was given bail of 5,000 rands. And that is all, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Abrahu. Any member of the delegation wants to add anything? Right, so let's get to the members. Honourable Lubati.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. My question is on the wrongful reporting of the duty officer, whether intentionally or unintentionally, I'm not sure. What happens to him? Where is he? Is he to him or her? What happened to him as we speak? Thank you.
Thank you, Jacob. The first question is just one for clarity. I missed the detail while we were getting the explanation. There was mention of someone who wasn't willing to speak to IPED in the course of the investigation. Can I just get clarity who that was? I'm guessing it might have been the owner of the residence with the surveillance system, but I just want to make sure of that. And then my second question is in relation to, this might be a question better answered by the SAPS perhaps actually, but should the members, as soon as SAPS reported it to the IPED, should those members not have gone on immediate suspension? I mean, there was a fairly obvious case here, even if formal process or maybe findings was not done. But is there not provision that under these very extreme and very horrible circumstances, there should be immediate preliminary suspension? And then at the conclusion of formal investigation, there would then be final sanction applied.
Honourable Grunewald, then Honourable Ramatakane, and very nice last.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I just want to clarify, I was not sure, but do I understand that there are 2 years? Was it only the one video? from the CCTV of the owner of the house? Or did the police have their own video? I'm not sure, but I'd want to like clarity on that. And then further on, I'd also like to know the members who've been charged now. I suppose logically they are suspended. With or without food? Thank you.
No, thank you, Honorable Chair. Just the follow-up on the question of the CCTV footage. What I want to know is the, given that the footage was taken by the CCTV camera, whether the APEC have already taken steps to make sure that those materials have been secured and authenticated as the provisionally taken. Number two, the issue about, I think I read something about the station commission of that place that was only saying that we've heard about this, but there is no, members have not yet been suspended because we still have to take statement. I just want to find out that particular action, whether indeed action has been taken by the station in terms of suspending those members. Basically the kind of what goes into a departmental issue.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. First, I mean, I think I'd like to express my disgust yet again about this incident. It's really, to me, an appalling incident that took place. But at the same time, I have to commend the IPRIPL, the very swift action that has taken in fulfilling its legislative mandate. I think it's clear that there were serious concerns within the IPRIPL about, and it was effectively addressed. To echo Honorable Molebati, I believe my question was on consequences for the contradictory reports, but I'm assuming that would be covered in the Defendant of Justice charge, because it is also a very serious issue for me. What is concerning to me is also that on the face value, it had to appear on the Sunday Times front page before any action was taken on the part of the police in suspending, or I'm saying that IPA didn't do a job before then, but it had to become a public issue before there was decisive action taken against officers involved. What I'm more interested in is what happens now going forward. I understand that officers are working under harrowing conditions with a constant threat to their life. We hear often about police killings on duty. There was one yesterday in October, if I remember correctly. And I can understand that there is, and they're taking a great threat to their life, but the action taken in this incident was completely disproportionate and completely unwarranted. But what we need to understand is what drives our officers to this is a lack of training, is a lack of knowledge of the law, is it psychological factors, emotional, traumatic factors, and then how do we deal with this in the service, which is a recommendation I believe that I can make to the police and court, or perhaps even from the civilian secretariat. But also, is it not worth considering, as is done in some states in the United States, having constant video footage when officers are on duty or respond to a call, either affixed to the car or in the form of something like a GoPro attached to the officer himself when they are responding to these things, so that we can monitor their conduct and hold them better accountable? Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. Executive Director Daniel King.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I may start with some of the questions. The issue of the wrongful reporting, Honourable Members and Chairperson. Remember when the duty officer attended the scene, he relies on what would be given to him by the members there. He does not necessarily have to he was not there himself. So he relies on what these members tell him. So if they colluded themselves before they call anyone to say, this is the story that we are going to stick to, this is what they stick to. My understanding is what they told him, because that's what he has written. What had happened in this instance is the only mistake that this member made was he did not talk to what individual members said to him. And that part was covered when we actually went back to him to investigate because we wanted to bring in this charge of defeat the end of justice. What did individual members tell him? So, and then he clarified that this is what happened, because before that his statement was actually saying, this is what I heard from the members. Sort of actually saying all of them said the same thing, you know. But then he had to individualize what this particular member said so that we can actually individualize what this member said from then on. But with regard to what happened, why the members gave the wrongful, you know, probably they were trying to protect themselves. They themselves, because they are the accused anyway, because they wanted to protect themselves from being charged. That's why they lied to their own officer at the time. But then the part is then covered by the defeating part of in the criminal court.
Did I hear you well? When you this time, when he receives this information, he doesn't be verified. He either goes to report whether it's true or what. Did I hear you well?
Thank you, Member, Mr. Ramabu.
Chairperson, this is exactly what happened. The officer, when officer went to the scene, he asked the members what happened, and they related the story that this was a robbery going on, and they arrived, and this person shot at them, and they retaliated, they shot him back, and then he got killed. So that's the story that they gave him. And he gave us that story. When our members went to the scene, that's the story that he gave them. And our members got there, the firearm was still there, and the only way for us to find out is to actually do further investigation, to actually get to the truth of the matter of what happened. Because then the body as it is, it will tell you, as in this case, whether this person was shot while lying down or he was shot while running away. So as the postmortem revealed at a later stage, that this is what happened. But with regard to what the officer at the scene that visited the scene, this is the story that was told by his member.
So I don't want us to go into the detail. It might compromise the criminal investigation. So I think we're going to I'm not going to allow that. Let's get the other responses.
Can I continue with the other questions? The second question was whether this who was not willing to speak to IP. This is the video operator. The one that the footage was used. So he did not want to speak to us. We're not sure exactly what the reason was, why he did not want to speak to our members. But then when the police approached, because remember this video, he has given it to the police himself. And when the police went back to actually try to speak to him about it, it was then that he agreed to talk to our members, and then they took that statement to authenticate the video.
Sorry, Chair, I just made some semantics. So we told us the video operator, is that a separate person from the owner of the residence?
That's the owner of the premises. Yeah. The issue as to whether these members should not be suspended immediately, that could well be answered by the station themselves, because obviously this matter was reported to them first. And as I said, the video went to them first, and they brought the video to us. So nothing happened up until we sent those recommendations to them. When I actually tried this, I spoke to them yesterday. I think they were in the process of actually doing it. They wanted to serve the suspension letters on them. Not sure whether that happened or not. That was yesterday.
You said the floor.
Please, I'm still not clear. So there are two videos. Because the police had their own video operator. Do I understand it correctly? Because that was certainly also my question, but I didn't receive an answer.
Yes, Mr. Abraoui.
We put only one video that was coming from the police. Remember, I said this operator, the owner of the premises gave it to the police, and the police brought it to us. So, but it is, we're not sure, because then we saw the second video. The second video related to the incident, what we saw on Monday when we went to effect an arrest. The video actually shows the deceased shooting at the police vehicle, which we do not have currently. That's the video. We don't know where they got that video. So we're still trying to find the original video. As where the video comes from, we're not sure.
So, Chair, this is important. So there are two videos. The source, it seems, we don't really know. If I listen to what...
So it's part of the investigation, so I think...
I understand that. But the video was circulated on YouTube. Which one is that one?
I suppose the video, I'm not sure which one is on the YouTube, but the one that we're talking about is the one where it shows the police the killing this person. Because the second video that actually came into the fore on Monday for us was the video where it shows the member moving from the business premises where he conducted the robbery and running away from the police, also shooting at the police vehicle. So that's part of the video we don't have. So we only got to know about it on Monday.
Continue. Welcome to continue. Meanwhile, welcome to the Acting National Commissioner, General Pafana in the State.
Thank you, Sir. The question was as to whether members were suspended without pay. I suppose because members of Sub-Saharan here would have to answer to that one. As I already said, that my understanding was that they were planning to suspend these members yesterday. As to the issue appearing on Sunday Times before any action could be taken, as in my initial explanation I said, after the completion of the investigation, when we wanted to conduct pre-effect an arrest, one of the members was not available. And hence then, that would have been before the Sunday Times expressly. So, as you've seen this in Sunday Times, we actually even spoken to Sunday Times reporter to say we are investigating the matter and our investigation is at a very advanced stage at the time when we spoke in. I guess that concludes our questions. Mr. President, I'm not sure if I have anything to add.
Mr. Khomiani, any outstanding questions?
Thanks, Mr. President. I will possibly go back in respect to what Mr. Aburabi has covered in respect of some of the questions. I think with regards to the issue of the suspension or the initiation of the departmental steps against such members, such regulations, they are very clear that immediately as and when the commander becomes aware of the conduct of his or her supervisee, he just has to start immediately initiating the departmental steps against that particular member. If the question is the availability of the documentation because the document is the IP, we don't have a problem. The relationship with SAPS is very good. Even when they want the documentation from us, what is contained in the document, we don't have a problem giving them those of the documentation, so that they just have to start with the departmental steps. But the issue of the suspension is a management issue that resides with SAPS. We'll also see in all our recommendations to SAPS, we only recommend departmental steps to be taken against SAPS members. We don't say anything with regards to the suspension. So that's the prerogative of SAPS management. The issue in respect of one or two videos there, all of these things will form part of our investigations because we are still busy with this particular case, the investigations of this particular case, including the validation and the authenticity of the video because we still have to send it to forensics to be analyzed and confirm that it's the original. Honorable Member Ramatakane. Okay, the issue of the station commander is covered with regard to waiting for the statements from IPH in respect of the Sunday Times issue. What the paragraph would indicate that the member was not available around Gauteng. The information was that he went to Limpopo, and no one knew about his address at Limpopo to his current alone. Because there is nothing stopping us from arresting the member from where he is. We don't have to wait for him to come to the station and only arrest the member is there. What drives subs to do this kind of things and the video footage is going forward to be included in the subs speakers, possibly to form part of the recommendations going to subs, but that has to do with subs management. And in respect of what happened going forward, that will also be covered in our recommendations, because we don't only do criminal and departmental recommendations, but we also, in terms of our act, do recommendations that will influence the existing policy within subs to subs themselves. And secretary, they will take it from there. That is sufficient.
Thank you very much. I think maybe on that last point, that is a matter that could be referred to the consultative forum between the secretariat and IPED. Maybe while we've got Gauteng Commissioner here today, maybe just to get an indication, I think SAPS became aware of the footage on the 20th of October, according to the report we received today. But the officers implicated were only suspended on Monday, this last Monday. I just want to know the lapse in terms of that process. National Commissioner, anything?
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. What featured in the Sunday Times remains unfortunate, that we could have such act committed by our members. It is against the spirit of the Constitution and goes against everything that the law prescribes. Thus, when such is brought to our attention, we take action. The intended suspension of the station commissioner is informed by exactly the fact that he or she will have received that information much earlier before we saw it in the newspapers. And having seen, had access to the video and what had happened, nothing was done on their part. So when the matter came to our attention on Sunday, I immediately engaged the provincial commission, and we sanctioned a process to ensure that the disciplinary steps are taken against those involved. We could not influence the process in as far as the criminal part of the investigation is concerned. Thus, that part was left to the IPED, but we also could not wait for a recommendation from IPED, because we viewed that what was displayed as very serious, and thus action was taken. What we did, normally the regulations provide for longer timelines for a person to respond on why he or she should or should not be suspended. In this case, the provincial commissioner issued the intent and notice of suspension with the provision that we must get responses within 48 hours during which the suspensions would have been activated. Simply put, the lapse is solely because that was never escalated to our level much earlier. But when it got to our attention, we certainly took action, and we will do so to make sure that we restore order in this organization. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Acting National Commissioner. I think from the committee side, we welcome your commitment to constitutional conduct by members, and that there will consequences, which we think is important. I think we highlighted earlier this year with a lot of the cluster commanders. Now, if such an incident happens, you know, at least the station commander must escalate it to the cluster commander. The cluster commander must escalate it to the provincial commissioner. So there must be a process. So I think this incident again shows that that link should be revisited as a matter of priority. Also now, BRR recommendation that was adopted on Thursday, I think, by Parliament, to be specifically focused on the issue of clusters to ensure that the management link between station and province of strength. So I think that's critical. Because the lapse, it's a pity that it happened. I think we welcome the steps, the disciplinary steps taken, but I think there should be, as we said in other reports during this year, should be close management of those matters. Because such an incident has got a very negative reflection on SAPS. I mean, there's 200,000 members, it's only a small percentage that made them guilty. In such instances, even if you look also at IPED annual report, the numbers, but it's quite critical that from the management side, if there's not compliance, the station commanders do not report, there must be consequences. So that would be our view on it. I want to move on, but if members want to come in on the floor.
Thank you, Chair. I still didn't hear whether the station was with or without pay. And I'm asking this question specifically to the Chairperson, because in my view, there's a tendency when we have members of the police services with lower ranks, then they get suspended without pay. But the moment it gets a specific rank, then it's suspended with pay, which I think is unfair. So I just want clarity on that, please.
You allow that, Honourable Bailey, you allow us.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a quick follow-up to the acting commissioner. Obviously, it's good news to hear that there will be follow-up action for the local station commissioner and his sort of failure to act according to regulations. But as the Chairperson says, that party speaks to weaknesses in that link between, you know, from local level to cluster level and escalating further. But I think there's also a management competency dimension to it as well on the part of the station commissioner, which to me says that this failure was, his or her failure was the result of willful contravention of the regulations if they knew what had to be done, or there was ignorance on their part, which they speak to inadequate training. So I just want to confirm and verify if the disciplinary process that goes forward will also look into and investigate the exact reason why this happened, so that both corrective measures can be put in place not to have that same failure. As well as to also determine whether across the board there is adequate training on this kind of issue so it doesn't repeat itself in other environments.
Thank you, members. Jennifer Hammer.
Thanks, Chair. There's a saying that goes, no stone will left unturned, and let not fight in this case. So we need to look at this matter from all angles, whether the immediate supervisor, what is it that is done once this matter surfaces? The station commander, in terms of all the bridges and all that, will be part of the investigation which is conducted to deal with the misconduct part, which is the going against the spirit of the discipline regulations. And of course, when you look at that, you don't only look at from a punitive measure perspective, but there is also a developmental element which is very critical that cannot be overlooked. Now, Chair, on the question of whether with or without pay, the discipline regulations provide that you give a member a notice. In giving a member, you say we intend to suspend you without benefits. You allow the member to make a representation. You consider the representation, and only following having received the representation, you make a decision whether it is with or without aid. The discipline regulations are not selective. The discipline regulations apply across the board. So it is the seriousness of the matter, the circumstances surrounding the matter at hand, and that enables the decision maker to take a decision on whether it is with or without pay. So I'll be preempting the situation then if I were to say that these members are suspended with or without pay. Due process will be followed and the outcome thereof will determine what actions we are taking. Important is to know that discipline enforcement thereof is not the responsibility solely of the national commissioner or of the provincial commissioner or divisional commissioners. All managers on all levels are obliged to enforce discipline. In actual fact, the discipline regulations say the immediate commander will, if a matter of breach in terms of the code comes to his or attention, should take disciplinary action. Thus, we consider it serious that the station commander would have covered up in this case, would not have initiated any action at the point that he or she received the information of what has happened there. And this is part of what we will enforce, taking cue from what we said is a priority in the organization, enforcement of command and control. Because it can't be just an academic thing. It must become real on the ground. And people must account on their actions at all levels within the organization. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you. Are you covered?
Maybe just a brief comment. And related to what the International Police Commission has just said, I think it's evident that there was a breakdown in communication between station and the provincial commissioner or his office, because as an incident like this poses a serious threat to the reputation, the credibility, and various other governance issues in the staff. And I think it should be compulsory to immediately report an incident of this grade and actually to the provincial commissioner to make sure that this does not happen, that we don't have a situation where it appears in the Sunday Times and then notice of issue for intention to defend. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. But the other person that must be followed up is this duty officer who reported wrongly. To find out what was the intention of this wrong reporting. What was the intention? Thank you.
I think it may miss, I'm going to close the book on this one here. Yes, General.
Honourable Chair, first, the fact that someone was shot and killed by the police would have been reported immediately. But what was not made visible to us was the cover-up. It is only when the video surfaced that you started realizing, hang on, what was reported is actually the opposite of what happened. Thus, action. And I agree with Honorable Mulebati that the investigation, whether criminal or departmental, at least departmental, will not only be limited to the four plus station commander. We need to look at the chain and say, where was this breach? Where was the lapse? And then we must deal with it accordingly. So, just going back to Honorable Member, yes, we would have known that in pursuing a suspect, a member or members would have shot someone and killed someone. But we did not have the details of the deviation, where, for example, this thing literally boils down to execution, which is provided nowhere in our prescripts. If that member, if that suspect was shot to be able to effect an arrest and he or she surrendered, there is no reason why we should go further. We should effect an arrest or maybe get him or her arrested, taken to a hospital for treatment, be under guard, and then deal with it from there. So the breach will be dealt with accordingly.
Thank you, Isaac, for the report. We will be looking forward to the finalization of that matter. It's quite critical that Isaac must play its role if there is criminal conduct by SAPS members and is brought to the courts in terms of our constitutional dispensation and that the matter can be handled. Also from the side of SAPS, disciplinary steps, but again the question of management from the province to cluster, but also importantly the question of visible policing, the management of visible policing. We spoke about that, I think, 3 weeks ago, the question again of the pocketbooks. If there was 4 officers on scene, was this incident reflected in the pocketbook? In terms of inspection that should have taken place when they fall out in the afternoon, was that reported? All those linkages, again, visible policing, critical. And from our side, at the National Commission, we have to closely watch visible policing from the portfolio committee side. Because most of the incidents reported in the updated annual report is from visible, because I'm in that forefront in fighting crime. But then we must ensure that our members, the training, also the counselling, when they go out, they are under difficult circumstances, but also the command and control of the small units must get special attention, that younger members or junior members don't act illegally and extrajudicially. So that's going to be monitored very closely by the portfolio committee. Thank you. We will now move to the next item. As indicated last week and the previous week, we're going to focus on the issue, the management of the student protests countrywide, but also the issue of the breach of the national key point in the parliament. Because I remember from the annual report that was tabled here during the breach of our process, there was only one breach last year countrywide in terms of the annual report. So we already had a breach at parliament, so we must look at that and in terms of the processes, and is there any lessons we can learn and what should be done additionally to ensure that there's proper management of that process. Then IPET will give us a report on all complaints that they received in terms of the student protest, complaints against members of SAPS, any investigations, that we get just a picture on that. Maybe just to emphasize what the portfolio committee said even before the protest happened Wednesday, 3 weeks ago. We highlighted the importance that the management of conflict at various institutions, that's actually the task of the vice-chancellors and the councils. They should deal with that. We also saw with our oversight visits during through the various provinces with service delivery protests. At the end of the day, the police become the first responder. And they're not supposed to be the first responder. The first responder is where that conflict happens. For instance, in a municipality, be it the councillor, the municipal council, the municipal manager, or the council. They should deal with it. And then maybe province. But in many instances, the police are kind of forced into a situation where they should be the first responder. So I think from the portfolio committee side, we also called on all role players, before even the protest, that there should be constitutional conduct. It should be done within the law. There should be proper consultation. We also ask for restraint on all parties. So from our side, we said that that should be the framework. We had the incident at Parliament, of course, we'll come to the breach issue, but also to look at the situation countrywide, where in some instances also escalated to some serious violence. But I think the departure point is your constitutional democracy. People must be allowed to protest peacefully within the law and within prescripts, and that's quite important. Police, of course, only the last resort. We also said, for instance, at campuses, the police shouldn't be the first resort by the university councils and the vice-chancellors. There should be mechanisms at those institutions to deal with those conflicts. If there's problems, private security or other role players should become involved. But really, the police, the last resort. And then we've seen two instances where two universities also kind of bought into this, and the police were actually obliged in terms of the law to act. In the end, the vice-chancellor drew that they bought into this. So it also put the police in a very difficult situation. So I think part of this discussion will also to be a reflect on that, you know, the role of the various institutions within society, what is their role. But let's go first to IPET in terms of their presentation. And I think they will give the police an opportunity, and then we'll take questions to both delegations. Mr. Khamriani, welcome to start.
Thanks, Mr. President and honorable members. The purpose of the presentation is to brief the Portfolio Committee on Police on IPET's investigations of cases relating to the alleged police actions during the 2015 #FeesMustFall student protests. With regards to the background there, it is alleged that that block protest or hashtag #FeesMustFall started on the 14th of October at Wits, and it spread to some of the institutions, and as a result, the South African Police Service, in particular POPS, had to manage and control the crowd for public order and safety. And in terms of the IPIC Act, Section 29 of the IPIC Act, it states that the station commander or any member of the South African Police Services or NPS have an obligation to report to the IPIC any matters regarding the types of cases reported, investigated by IPIC in terms of Section 28 of the IPIC Act. Those particular cases in respect of Section 28, we talk about Section 28.1A up until H, as well as 28.2. So most of the cases there, it will be, most of them must be the dead in police custody, dead as a result of police actions, the discharge of official firearms, the assault or torture, raiding custody, rape by such members, the corruption, the system corruption, and the referrals of any other matter that is not covered under that particular section. I did receive a total of 70 cases which were brought to the attention of us. Eastern Cape 4, Northwest 8 cases, Free State 1, Gauteng 1, and Western Cape 3. Nothing from Northern Cape, KZN, Mpumalanga, and Limpopo reported to the IPIC as per Section 29. As in terms of those particular cases, on slide 6, we have the summaries there, Northwest 8, all of them are for GBH. Eastern Cape 4, we have 3 discharge of official firearms, and assault GBH 1, Free State 1, common assault, Western Cape 3, discharge of official firearm 1 and 2 and 1 common assault. Gauteng 1, which is assault, in total 70. Then in those particular blocks there, columns, we indicated the institution and the alleged incident and date. That particular alleged incident of the date is what transpired on that particular day that the SARS has to manage the arrest by SARS, not by the IPIC. On the third column, then the fourth column, they reported cases at police stations. Immediately after, most of them, it was after they were released from custody. And then the status of IPIC investigations. I will start in the northwest, which is the Mabato campus. There was nothing from Porter's room. The incident happened on the 21st of October 2015, where it was alleged that the student violated the roads around the university precinct with burning tires and rubbles. Out of every incident, 41 students were arrested on that particular day. Immediately, and they appeared on court, and the matter was remanded to the 28 January 2016, and immediately after the release, and 8 of them, they reported the assault cases to the IPIC, indicating that during this particular arrest they were assaulted by the police. Hence, the injuries there were sustained during the shooting by the rubber bullets, and the victims are the age is 19-23. IPIC is currently pursuing investigations of the 8 cases of assault GBH as per most of the cast numbers from Mabato police stations, all of them. Then we do have underneath the IPIC CCN numbers, and in all these particular cases they indicated the victims that they are unable to identify the subs numbers. Into the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University incident that happens at Somerset, and also on 21st of October, there were no arrests. The case was registered as a discharge of an official firearm, because in respect of the obligations there on Section 29, perhaps they are supposed to report those discharge of official firearms, and that's where IPIC will come in after receiving the report with our file after we have registered the file number there, then we'll do the preliminary investigations in order to determine if the actions of the police were justifiable or warranted particular shootings. And if there was a justification, then we close our file with the preliminary reports. But if not, then it's ended, we take a decision as expected to register a case and do the full investigations. More especially when you find that people who discharge have resulted into the attempted murders and the malicious damage to properties. Then the Walter Sisulu there is one case where the complainant is alleging that while they were dispersing peacefully, a spark grenade was thrown at her and she was injured on her back. And the staff called the ambulance and complainant was taken to a hospital. With regards to that particular matter from the East London, we do have the identification of the suspect, the captain within the South African Police Service, so we are busy with that particular investigations. The case that was opened at Assault BBH, the Walter Sisulu University East London. That one together with the next one on the slide number 11, in actual fact is combined because those particular institutions they were combined during that particular protest. So the report that came from SARS, it was inclusive of the two institutions. And even with regards to us, I did our case number, the CCN number 2015-10-05-11. It's one covering the two institutions, but even with regards to that, there were no arrests by SARS. They managed to manage the situation, and just because there were rubber bullets that were fired, but not anyone injured, then they had to report that particular matter for the IP to conduct the preliminary investigations. On the next court here, matter of the 22nd of October, they barricaded the road, burning tires, when police tried to open the roads, they were allegedly thrown at pistols by the protesting students. They used some grenades and rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse the crowd, and there were no arrests. The case was reported to the IP discharge of an official firearm. In all this particular discharge of official firearm is the shootings in respect of the rubber bullets. There were no live rounds or handguns that were used by the police. The next one of the 23rd of October 2015, Fort Hare University at Alice. Same issue there, there were no arrest by the police, but the case of the discharge of official firearm was reported at IPIT, and we are doing the investigations. The University of the Free State, there is a female student journalist in the early 20s complained that she was assaulted by the police officials during a student protest in the week of the 19th to 23rd of October 2015, and we registered a common assault case there. Under public case number and CCN number from IPIT, and we are investigating, but the suspect is alone by the victim herself. The University of Cape Town, it was on the 21st of October. The health officials has to use crowd management and all of those things, but even on this one, there were no arrests, and there is a case of common assault that was reported by SARS to the IPIT, and we do have the IPIT case number there. Then the University of Cape Town, the next one, no arrest of UCT, the discharge of an official firearm with an IPIT CCN number there. The other case still on the university, it was on the protest of the 27th, also it's a discharge and registered with an ICD CC number there. The last one on the University of the Departure Strength, authorities alleged that Mr. A.M. Malam, the complainant, was visiting the university when at the gate, he was at the boom gate, then he was approached by the students as and when they wanted to remove the car key from the ignition there. Then he fought with regards to them. He further alleged that he took out his gun and pointed it at the protesters, who then retreated, but the police approached him and assaulted him. So even that the case has been registered under Bristol, case number there, assault, and is being investigated by the IPT. In conclusion, the IPT will thoroughly investigate all the reported cases and send recommendations to SAPS in respect of the financial matters, and in respect of the criminal matters, it will send those recommendations to the DPP. And the last point of bullet there, as the IPT would like to commend and applaud SAPS, especially SAPS management and public order policy, for the way in which they have dealt with the hashtag "This was fall" situation under the circumstances. It could have been worse than what prevails on those particular days, because there were no deaths as a result of police actions. Even those that were arrested, there are no deaths in police custody reported to the IPT. The only cases there is the assault and the discharge of officials. But you look also, even with regards to the arrest in the state of the protesters there, it was minimal. And we just have to attest that possibly the issue of training is now starting to bear some fruits in respect of how POPs are supposed to manage crowd management. Thanks, Chairperson, and honorable members.
Right, thank you. We will come to questions after the SAPS presentation. We will now allow the Acting National Commissioner and his team to present. Acting National Commissioner, maybe you can just introduce your team. You're welcome.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, thank you very much for the opportunity presented to us to feedback on the work that we have done in the past 2 weeks or so. When the students embarked on a hashtag #FeastMustFall, we embarked on hashtag #MaximumRestraint. And we are grateful that after 2 weeks of being under siege, we can safely say that there were no fatalities. As the head of the IPT is reporting, there will be cases, of course, that will have been reported, assault and so on. But if you take that in relation to the attack, we are bound to applaud the members in how they manage the situation. Let me first introduce the delegation. Next to me is Lieutenant General Sitole, the Deputy National Commissioner responsible for policing. There is Lieutenant General Mutiwa, the Provincial Commissioner of Gauteng. And we have Major General Kwena, the Acting Divisional Commissioner of Protection and Security Services. And on my right is Lieutenant General Mawela, the Divisional Commissioner of Operational Response Services. And there is Major Aladeil from the ORS Environment. We also have behind me Brigadier Mukanazi, who is also from the Operational Response Services Environment. And I'll call him the honorary member, because every sitting he's here. We are changing Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Payne, who is our secretariat in this regard. I hope I have covered all. I must not exclude the man at the back. He's very important to me because he's protecting me, Warrant Officer Rajapola. Chair, against any form of attack, just to make sure that we keep this nation very safe, and we'll do that proudly. Chair, also General Mohlala, I just ask you to check if whether we can have a representative from the Western Cape province, because they are at the same time appearing before the provincial legislature. So I'm just looking at maybe one of them being here, since we'll be dealing with a matter that will have happened in this case. That is short, the delegation, Chair. I'm going to, with your permission, allow Major General Alan Day to take us through the presentation.
Thank you, Acting National Commissioner, and you're welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee on Police. Chair, we received a tasking that we should reach this Portfolio Committee on the management of breaches national key points, as well as the response to the recent student protests. The scope of our presentation will deal with the management of breaches national key points in general, the overall security arrangements at National Parliament, security challenges experienced at Parliament, then the response to the recent student protests will deal with background, then the exposition of incidents that happened on the 21st of October at Parliament, as well as the 23rd of October at the Union Buildings, and then an overview of other incidents at higher education institutions across the country, and we'll close off with the current status and the way forward. First, and then firstly, the management of breaches at national key points. So in terms of Section 28 of the National Key Point Directive, when an incident occurs at any national key point, the owner of that national key point must notify the protecting unit and the secretariat by telephone without delay, investigate the incident, submit a written report to the protecting authority and the secretariat. Then the Joint Priority Committee should meet without delay to discuss the incident and issue an order to investigate, report, and improve the safeguarding if necessary, in addition to the reporting of the incident to the protecting authority, which is SAPS, the National Key Point Secretariat at the Division of Protection Security Service, must then be notified immediately. The initial report must be submitted to the Secretariat as soon as possible thereafter, and completed report preferably followed up and within 14 days. And in terms of the National Key Point Act 102 of 1980, any occurrence which causes loss, damage or disruption, or which immobilizes or adversely affects production, or causes death or injury to any person at or in the vicinity of a national key point. Then in terms of the Protection Security Services definition for security breach, it says any unauthorized access into the protected installation or residence and any illegal or unauthorized item that went through the system undetected to such premises. And then a security incident is any criminal conduct or occurrence inside the protected installation or residence other than a security breach. The Chairperson and Honourable Members, the incident at Parliament on the 21st of October is not considered a National Key Point security breach, as the incident occurred outside the National Key Point as defined in the National Key Point Directive, and we will deal in the later slides on the actual National Key Points that is situated on the parliamentary precinct. We just go to the hyperlink. Chairman, you will see this is a copy of paragraph 28 of the actual National Key Point Directive, and what is important there is that the initial breach must be reported, given the date and the time of the incident, and a short, concise report on the incident based on the available information. And if you slightly scroll down, Kevin, you then say the complete report that must be submitted within 14 days deals obviously with date and time, what has happened, where did it happen, how did it happen, and who was responsible, as alluded to earlier in this presentation. Go back to the presentation. Next slide, please. In as far as Parliament is concerned, we have a National Key Point number 19, which is the Parliament Chamber in the House.
number 20, 120 Plain Street Building, and then number 013-4300, which is Painhouse. Now, in terms of the existing joint planning committees, we see there's a joint planning committee for the presidency, also including the presidential residences, and then there's a plan committee for 120 Plain Street, of which the chair is the regional manager for the Department of Public Works, and then we have a joint security committee that must be established at Parliament, which the chair is the security head of Parliamentary Protection Services. Now, in an emergency situation, all three of those structures are being combined. Then the GCPS chairperson of the Presidency, 120 Plain Street, and Parliament Protection Services on the day were sensitized, and they were informed about pending protests due to the right of Parliament. There were no special JDC convened due to the following reasons. There are announced and unannounced marches of Parliament that occur on a daily basis. Although the gathering was unannounced, it started off as peaceful and under control. All relevant officers were mobilized to deal with the situation at hand, and the situation within the precinct was managed and dealt with within 14 minutes by the relevant role players, inclusive of the public order precinct units of SAP. Chairperson, what is currently displayed?
Sorry, just one question. Just for clarity, we will go to business like that. In terms of slide 5, you say the JEC to be re-established Parliament. Is it not currently functioning? Just for the explanation.
Chairperson, is my understanding that it's not functioning as a full JPC with all the relevant role players. However, there are security meetings that's taking place between specifically the South African Police Service as well as in the Parliamentary Protection Services. General Quinnam, however, might have more detail for you.
If you have questions, we will go to that. You can continue. Okay.
See, the slide indicates the its aerial view of the parliamentary precinct, which is roughly indicated and demarcated with a red broken line. The three national viewpoints is reflected, as mentioned, and what comprises the parliamentary precinct, so the red area, is the Freemasons building, which is a private building not utilized by Parliament, the Goodall building, Painhouse, the National Assembly, Purthouse, the National Council of Provinces, Marks Building, 90 Plain Street Building, and specifically those floors occupied by Parliament, 120 Plain Street, both in terms of 100 Plain Street and 120 Plain Street, then Africa House and the Visitor Center. The next section, Chair, will deal with the overall security arrangements that's currently in place at National Parliament. And this slide depicts that. You will see that on the precinct we have the Division of Protection and Security Services, and specifically the Western Cape office. They have a responsibility on precinct area as per their mandate to do access control measures. They then operate the X-ray machines and metal detectors at the entrances. They do the patrolling of the precinct, also closed circuit television monitoring, and then chamber protection. Then on the inner perimeter of the national key points, we have Parliamentary Protection Services as per a approved security policy that is in place. They are in compliance with the NIS document. They do screen and confirmation of visitors, and they are responsible for chamber security. On the right-hand part of that slide, you will notice that the public order policing have a responsibility on the outer perimeter, outside of the demarcated precinct area, as per their mandate, which is contained in the Gatherings Act 205 of 1993, and then also there's a crowd management national instruction 4 of 2014, which then places the responsibility in terms of their handling of a crowd management situation. Inside the precinct, public order policing will enter the precinct to render assistance in policing upon the request then from Protection Security Services. Chair, then this part will deal with current security challenges, mostly in terms of the physical security measures that is not in place at the parliamentary precinct. Reference is made to poor access control systems at vehicle and pedestrian entrances, the lack of shelters at vehicle entrances, which provides for poor working conditions, specifically during inclement weather, for those police officers operating there. The inadequate perimeter fence, which at some areas is only 1.2 to 1.5 meters, specifically at the back of the parliamentary precinct,
and it's your understanding that there are limitations in terms of heritage restrictions, that there's no designated security checkpoint for delivery vehicles and trucks, and that there's inadequate infrastructure to cater for buses and heavy-duty vehicles. Now, Kevin, if you just open the hyperlink, please. Now, on the 12th of December 2013, the specific security challenges, as summarized in the slide, were listed in a letter addressed to the Director General of the Department of Public Works, and a number of those aspects are still requiring attention. Without going through the whole letter, Chairperson, you see the first paragraph, number one, refers to several security assessments that were done at the parliamentary precinct as from 2004. With the intention to upgrade and improve physical security, and the concern was expressed that very little has been done to address that. And then the concerns are summarized in paragraph 3.1, indicate the need for a search valve or a checkpoint where vehicle delivery and removal trucks will have to go through to be searched. Currently it's been done at the Lely Street entrance, which is not suitable. It poses a safety risk to pedestrians. It's too narrow to handle the peak hour traffic and deliveries. There are no proper security facilities for security personnel and specialists to properly perform the security clearance functions. And there's not a proper search area for our canine handlers at the Lily Street entrance. If we go to the further on the next page, you see that the specific area that is known as the Old Swans Garage, which is in the parliamentary complex, has been identified to be converted so there is a facility available that can address those specific concerns. Paragraph 3.2, the upgrade of all entrances and access points. 3.3, the working conditions referring to the shelters and guard posts. And I've mentioned the elements of nature, the challenge during rainy season with deliveries when they have to be unpacked to be properly searched. Then if we go to paragraph 3.5, also an area for the control of a bus serving the parliamentary villages. Area is small and there's inadequate entrance to this street. 3.6, Chairperson, I've mentioned the height of the outer perimeter back fence specifically, which is a physical security measure. And Honourable Chairperson, members, you will have noticed the difference between the incident at Parliament as well as the one at the Union Buildings, where there was a proper security fence which in itself then assisted police on the handling of the incident. And then the last issue in that letter, Chairperson, refers to the permanent maintenance contract at the parliamentary complex, as well as the challenges with it. We go back to the presentation.
Just for clarity, General Alan Davis, that letter was sent in the first week of 2014.
It's dated on 12/12, sir.
And did SAT receive any feedback from Public Works?
Chairperson, in my consultation with the representative from Protection Security Service indicated that status quo is still the same. There are meetings taking place with the total upgrade of the parliamentary precinct, but it's not at this stage been addressed any of these concerns. Again, General Gwena might be in a position to give an update.
We will go to questions, but it's a very serious matter. It was not a SAT matter. SAPS has done the work in terms of writing. When we go to the discussion about that, you can continue.
Sorry, Chair. On that specific slide, there's a signature of the date of 29 January. What is that?
Listen, that is the date when it seems like that is a representative from the Department of Public Works. If you go to the next page, you'll see that the actual letter was signed by the National Commissioner on 12 December 2030. I do not know if that was the only time when the department then acknowledged receipt and submitted that back to
you. We'll come back to that in a question time. Right, General Anandar, you're welcome to continue.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of the, we can go to the slide 12, which deals with the background and the student protest. Okay, just a bit of background. On the 19th of October 2015, the Council of the University of Witwatersrand told students that it will communicate a decision on fees for the next academic year in November, which then angered protesters on campus, and the student leaders responded insisting that the students will shut down university and Gaza University will remain closed until the grievances are heard. And then on a day, major roads surrounding the university campus in Bramfontein and Parktown was blockaded. That obviously the protest actions by students from universities, technicons, as well as other places of tertiary education that are colleges, raised a concern in terms of the stability situation in the country. And we also, at the time, had a specific concern on the grade 12 examinations where our students were writing material and preparing for the matric exams. So I will then go directly to the incident that happened on the 21st of October. Again, to orientate the Honourable Committee, which I'm sure is very familiar with the layout of the precinct. It indicates the various buildings found within the precincts. I've listed them in an earlier slide. In this case, it's demarcated the precinct area with a yellow line. And this is just purely to give orientation, and it's a further orientation on the hyperlink, which will then go to the areas where there were specific concerns on the day. Okay, that is the aerial photograph. And as we look at that, there is in front, on the bottom part, was Lotus Plain Street. Then to the left is the Belvedere Gate. In police terms, we refer to that as X-ray 1. In the middle at the statue, X-ray 2. And then on the right-hand side, we have X-ray 3. And that is one of the gates that were forced open and where a number of the students entered onto the precinct area. To the next slide, it's just X-ray 3. The insert in the top giving the total orientation of the precinct area. Again, it's again Plain Street, gate that was forced open. The next slide is a closer view on the precinct area from the roof of the National Assembly. The next slide shows Lely Street entrance, the view from Plain Street. Why I'm showing this gate, there was a number of a splinter group of students that when they left the area from X-ray 3 in Plain Street, they wanted to enter there. There was a number of protection security services members that were posted at that gate and prevented entrance. And then they went around to the Spin Street entrance. The next slide is the same alley, just on the inside from the freezing area. Then going to the next slide is the Parliament Street, the view from Spin Street, another gate that was forced open. The slide to follow indicates the same Parliament Street from the steps. From the steps of the National Assembly. And then the last slide on this is Poortuis. A number of students, approximately 400, that came up Harlem Street, were stopped by members from Protection Security Services, as well as public order policing at the Poortuis entrance. Thank you, Kevin. And go to this slide. So on the 21st of October, members of public order policing were on duty. There was student protest at the University of the Western Cape, Belleville, NTEC Belleville, at the Rondebosch, as well as the Cape Peninsula University of Technology. There were no specific information or early warning on the protest action at Parliament that was received by public order policing. From 6 o'clock in the morning, when the first public order policing arrived on duty, they had to deal with barricades that was placed in front of the entrance at the Cape Peninsula University of Technology, as well as about 300 protesters blocking Symphony Way in Belleville. Just after 7 o'clock, Lower Baxton Road at UCT was also blocked and barricaded with concrete blocks. At that stage, there were 32 members of public order policing on duty to deal with crowd management situations. At 11:24 on that day, the operation commander of the public order policing Cape Town, Lieutenant Colonel Lucas, received information that students from UCT will make use of buses to go on to National Parliament and protest. The operational commander then conveyed the information to the Protection Security Service operational commander. And then the PSS had an additional deployment on the day due to the medium-term budget speech that was scheduled. And they had 80 members on deployment on the precinct area. Then, as I mentioned, 11:24, the information was that the group is on their way to Parliament to propose the protest hashtag fees must fall. The PSS deployment then increased at all the entrances, and all building entrances were locked. I can just mention that most of the information were received through social media, and there were no formal notice of gathering. At 12 o'clock in the day, approximately 1,000 students arrived at the main entrance in the Rurangski. The students were peaceful and the situation was contained. Public policing, the 32 members were deployed at the main entrance in Plain Street, that is X-ray to the middle of the statue where most of the students congregated. At 12:19, a single fire was set alight on the road. The students were then approached by the SAPS commander, as well as the deputy secretary to parliament, Mr. Yawa, to inquire what their demands were. No leadership could be identified, and an unknown African female reported that they wanted the Minister of Higher Education and the Minister of Finance to address them. The deputy secretary of parliament indicated that both the principals were occupied and could not address the students at that stage. The students were still peaceful and they showed no intended signs of any disruption. To the next slide, it's just indicating the and depicting the group of students and the burning tar in Plain Street in front of X-ray 2. We go to the next slide, which provides further the actual incident overview. At 14:30, groups of students broke away moving down Plain Street. At 14:40, they approached both the entrance in Plain Street and Parliament Street and forced their way through the locked vehicle gates and entered Parliament grounds from both sides. The group entering Plain Street was stopped by PSS and public order policing members approximately 5 meters away from the National Assembly. The group entering Parliament Street was stopped by the PSS members and public order policing members at the Poortuis entrance. It need to be mentioned at that stage that Parliament was in session, and the large number of students on the policing post disappeared nearest to the National Assembly. The public order policing operational commander made an operational decision to overcome this specific threat by a pushback maneuver by means of physically pushing back groups with shields towards the outside of both the gates. The participants were warned in both Tosa and English on various occasions by means of a public address system that the actions were illegal and that they must vacate Parliament policing. When the public order policing members applied the maneuver of the pushback, some of the participants violently resisted, and in the process 21 stun grenades, 2 smoke grenades, and pepper spray were used to move the participants out of the parliamentary grounds. At 15:30, they were chased out of the gates, and participants retaliated by throwing bricks, stones, bottles and various items at SAPS members. No buildings in the precinct were compromised, and none of the 3 national key points were reached or compromised. The 2 vehicle entrances were ever damaged, and the SAPS received no specific reports of injuries from any of the participants or staff to Parliament. Security forces reported few minor injuries, and then the medium-term budget switch continued uninterrupted. In this slide on the left, is the indication of the pre-incident that I've already highlighted to the portfolio committee. It shows on the yellow area the area in Plain Street where the students gathered prior to splitting into 2 groups and entering parliamentary precinct at upgrade X3 and the Spin Street gate. The incident slide on the right hand side depicts the movement of the 2 groups into the precinct with the green arrows, and in the blue arrows indicate the pushback out of the precinct in the opposite direction as they have entered. Next slide, please. The post-event on Jefferson, 6 arrests were made within the parliamentary precinct. The students, after they were pushed out, regathered in the Roland Street area. The 6 persons that were arrested were charged with the Cape Town pass number 1409/10 for trespassing and resisting arrest. In the meantime, the deployment of public order policing increased to 72 public order policing members that dealt with the situation outside the parliamentary precinct. The pushback outside of the parliamentary precinct occurred in the direction of the buses as well as the railway station, and in the process, some grenades and pepper spray were used. 23 people were arrested outside the gates of Parliament for public violence, and they were charged with the Cape Town pass 1421. Chair, this slide consolidates what I just presented to the Honourable Committee. the pre-incident on the left column from the time period 1155 to 1450, and in the middle the incident itself from 1450 to 1530, and post-incident from 1530 to 1930. And it's in the blitz, the information that there were buses on Parliament, the bus intercepted at Roland Street, the students that disembarked and were walking out, they first indicated that they're going to the Cape Town Peninsula University, and then they proceeded to the Roland Street. The information of the 1,000 students, the lockdown at the national key points, the redeployment of public order policing, the identification of the leadership to negotiate, and the engagement of parliamentary officials, the nearing the incident, the warning, the channeling of the participants, and then the process, shields and the tonfa, the stun grenades, the smoke grenades, the pepper spray, and the ultimate test, and post-incident, the gathering outside the gates, and then the throwing of stones, the burning of pins, in the warning from SAS, the channeling of the participants, and again shields and tonfa, stun grenades, pepper spray, and the rest. If you can just go to the hyperlink, please, Kevin. Just a few photos, Chairperson. The Roland Street into the parliamentary entrance prior to the actual incident. The next slide indicates also the gathering of students outside the parliament entrance in Plain Street. The next slide on the parliamentary precinct to orient that you on the left-hand side with the yellow arrow, the National Assembly, the steps. On the right-hand side, the actual Plain Street gate. And then the last slide is just indicating a few pictures at the gate as well as on the parliamentary precinct and down Parliament Street, the interaction between the police and the students. So, and then the last slide on the incident on the 21st. The accused have all appeared in court, were released on warning on various charges that's being investigated. There was an application brought before the Cape Town High Court interdicting the SAS with the interdict requesting that no use of force might be used by the SABS against protesting students. There were a judgment given, and if we go to the hyperlink, see that the applicants are listed there, Chairperson. There were 10 applicants, and it was against the Speaker of Parliament as the first respondent. Go down, please. Second respondent, the Minister of Higher Education, the Minister of Police, the third, and Provincial Commissioner of the Police in Western Cape. That's the fourth respondent on page 2. The rule of the court, the order of the court was that the applicants must undertake to do the following. They must comply with Section 17 of the Constitution. Not to hold and or participate in any public gathering and or demonstrations as defined in the Regulations of Gatherings Act without first obtaining authorization to do so. 1.3. Should they wish to hold demonstrations and or gatherings in the vicinity of court and or parliament, they shall comply with the Regulations of Gathering Act, in particular Section 7 thereof. 1.4. Insofar as gatherings or demonstrations at or near parliament, courts, and other national key points are concerned, the applicant shall observe the 100-meter radius and the demarcations as referred in the Regulations of Gatherings Act. 1.5, they should observe the radius respect of Parliament and demarcate it in the yellow bordered area. And then 1.6, the applicants will respect the national key points as defined in the National Key Points Act. Then in terms of the undertakings by the third and the fourth respondents, 2.1, so far as the applicants comply with the Regulations of Gatherings Act, the third and fourth respondents shall act in accordance with Section 9 thereof. And 2.2, the third and fourth respondents undertake not to use unreasonable force to disperse and or police legal gatherings and or demonstrations relating to tuition fee increases in South African higher education institutions, otherwise than in accordance with the law. Thank you. Clint, if we go back to the presentation. The response on the next slide to that specific incident on the 21st is that the NAD Joints convened an urgent meeting on that day at 17 hours where we reviewed the situation. We issued specific NAD Joints operational instructions. We started with the daily meetings of the NAD Joints. We have instructed the provincial joints to monitor all higher learning institutions as well as the Prof. JOCOM the operational committee to meet twice daily, that they should be constant liaison with provincial higher education departments on a provincial level, the increase and maintenance of police visibility as a proactive measure at all these specific hotspot areas, and in the provincial intelligence coordinating committees to increase the ground coverage. Chairperson, with your permission, if I may proceed, we will then go to the events at Union Buildings on the 23rd of October, when there was information received on the previous day, the 22nd, via social media and intelligence reports of students intent to embark on a hashtag Fees Must Fall protest march to the Union Buildings on the 23rd at 7 o'clock. This slide provides an aerial view of the Union Buildings, specifically the garden area on the south side, the south side norms, and the red area indicates the area where security fence came under pressure and where ultimately the vehicle gate was forced open. The overview of the incident on the 23rd of October, I've mentioned the students embarked on the Fees Must Fall protest march. At 11:55, there were approximately 50,000 students gathered at the Union Building on the lawns. On 12:30, the students broke the fence at the Union Buildings. 12:32, the students started to throw stones at such members, and they also started damaging private vehicles. And in the process on the lawns, they were burning portable toilets. 12:40, Minister Maslobo left the stage because the students threw stones at him, and they demanded to see the Honourable President, President Zuma. There were also a group of about 300 students that were chanting near that gate that was broken and opened. At 15:25, the students mobilized and they were going back to the fence. And at 15:30, they were throwing stones at the stage where President Zuma was supposed to address them. The instruction was then given to disperse the students. Public order policing started with a dispersal action where they used stun grenades, serious reduced rubber rounds, and pepper spray. The next slide deals with the damages, injuries, and the rest as a result of the incident. At 16:20, the students were blocking vehicles in the central business district of Pretoria. At 16:30, they closed vessels in Park Street with big rocks, and they also blocked a Coca-Cola delivery truck and looted the truck. At 17 hours, they divided into small groups and they blocked traffic and damaged vehicles. At 19:45, a number of students were looting liquor stores, and such members arrested 7 students, and they were detained at Sunnyside Police Station for public violence. A state vehicle, BRK666B, was damaged. Damage estimated 5,000 rand, and there was damage to property opened at Sunnyside. There was another state vehicle with the registration number BTJ477 damage. Minor damage estimated at 700 rand, and the case opened. There was also then a police vehicle, BTF028B, that was burned. The damage estimated at 250,000 rand. Case opened at Sunnyside. Another state vehicle, BPT180, was damaged, estimated at 40,000. Another state vehicle with registration on the BPZ465 was burned, damage estimated at 150,000, and case opened. There was a vehicle from the Department of Labor that was damaged, estimated at 50,000 rand, and case opened. Chikating restaurant windows were damaged, and the damage estimated at 7,000 rand, with the case opened. Two private vehicles were damaged, estimated at 10,000 rand, with two cases opened at Sunnyside as well as Pretoria Central. In the process, SAPS members used 17 stun grenades, 22 40mm CS rounds, and 8 students were arrested for public violence and charged with video cash at Sunnyside 854 of 10. Chairperson, injuries, 17 injuries by students were reported that we are aware of in terms of medical services that rendered medical assistance to them. Most of them were minor injuries, and most of them relate to rubber bullet injuries. And then police members, there were 13 1-3 SAPS members that were in the process in terms of rocks that were the members injured to faces, to their faces, legs, a lot of them on their hands. And all of them were treated. I think there were one member that had been admitted immediately at hospital, but was also released from hospital. The hyperlink chairperson will dictate to some of the pictures that I'm sure that everybody is familiar with, that have seen that, that it was portrayed in the media. That is the incident at a specific date, circled in red. Also the photo to follow. And the next photo also indicating at a specific date. So continue, please. Chairperson, these are some of the rocks and objects that were with these officers that were just up that first set of steps, as well as then the photo to follow. The next photo depicts one of the plastic portable toilets that was set alight. The next photo, a grouping of the students on the south lawns. And then the next slides are indicating damage to a specific police vehicle, Hartson vehicle, that were damaged and also overturned. And the next one on one of the vehicles that were removed from a parking area, carried out of the parking area and set alight in the street. So those were the incidents on the 23rd of October. Chairperson, then the other incidents. Again, you can open the Excel spreadsheet. To the Excel document, the student protest actions as they occurred at various higher education institutions across the country. The information is from the period 22nd of October and updated until the 30th of October. It lists more than 100 incidents, and in the interest of time and with the permission of yourself, I will only highlight some of the incidents.
General Analog, I think the slides from 30 onwards is that dialogue. For the major issues?
You know, the slides from 30 onwards are basically dealing with the current status, current situation. So, Chair, it's basically in the slide, we'll see the area in red. It is a specific instance, and I've highlighted those where there was specific action either required from the police or where there were serious damage to property, buildings that were damaged all over at various higher education institutions. Unless you want me to go through them, it is available in the written copy that we can make available. It's just an overview of the time, the institution, the overview, and the incident. We just reflected the nature of the specific incident. The cash numbers are reflected where applicable, and then the student numbers. So I'll take my guidance from you, sir.
So I think we'll take that and we'll study that. It's fine, can continue with the current situation.
Thank you, Jason. Next slide. The situation, as of the 28th of October, when we received a comprehensive internally coordinated committee report, indicate that the situation at the Eastern Cape, the classes at the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University that have resumed, the Walter Sisulu University had a meeting on the 27th and they've decided to resume classes on the 29th of October. The Walter Sisulu University, the IPICA campus, classes have not yet resumed. The Fort Erie University are still closed. East London, they've agreed that the classes will resume on the 29th. In Alison, East London, Fort Erie University, the classes will have resumed on the 28th of October. And in Grahamstown at the Rhodes University, the classes would have resumed on the 27th of October. The next slide deals with the provinces of Free State, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and Northwest. In Free State, a march that took place at the University of the Free State, and a memorandum was handed over. The classes are continuing. In Gauteng, there was again certain incidents. The students are basically divided into two groups. One of the groups are attending lectures, whilst others are still busy protesting. The classes at the Tshwane University of Technology are resuming at the time of the report on the 28th. KwaZulu-Natal has been quiet on the 27th in those specific incidents. In Limpopo, the University of Limpopo, Mashpelarin campus has not yet resumed classes, and then the Univin classes are continuing, as well as the Matsivangila College of Agriculture in Polokwane that will be closed for the week. In Northwest, the Mai King campus has been closed and will open on the 2nd of November, and in Kafeng, there was a specific movement that intended to hold a meeting regarding transformation at the Northwest University Fox's Twin campus. And then the last slide on that feedback, Chairperson, is the situation in Western Cape.
to LID, University of Cape Town, bullet number 3, classes being suspended until the 30th, and then contract workers demanding permanent employment intend to continue with protest on the 28th. Then I just, after the I compiled this presentation, received a more recent update from the Department of Higher Education, and basically in the Cape Town Peninsula University of Technology, worker classes remain suspended on Friday, 3rd October, across all campuses until further notice. Examinations are also postponed until further notice. Northwest University, classes have been suspended for 3 weeks. Students are to vacate residences by Friday, 30th of October. Management gives students time to refresh and prepare for the exams, which have been postponed to the 24th of November. The Tshwane University of Technology, all activities remain suspended at the Pretoria, Soshanguve and Garankuwa campuses. UCT campus remains closed until the 30th of October, and hopes for the academic program to resume on Monday, the 2nd of November. Free State, Port Air, the situation is back to normal. And then UWC is still closed, and management hopes that the academic program will resume on Monday. Examinations are expected to commence on the 9th of November. And Fritz, the Vice-Chancellor addressed a group of protesting workers and students who made a series of demands of management and provided management response to the demands. The university remains open and focused on its academic program and other operational functions. The police are on standby. There is a group of 20 students at the time of the report that have joined the workers in the protest. And then nearly done. The next slide indicates the monitoring of the education-related cases, and it's a consolidated overview of the cases that resulted from student protests. And this data is valid until the 28th of October. You'll see that the columns per province, the first one indicates the number of cases, 51. Already on the quadrille, 18. Planner investigation, 24. In total, cases being monitored on 207 suspects that have been arrested. There's one case in KwaZulu-Natal for guilty verdict. Then undetected cases were closed, and then there's still no cases withdrawn by the National Prosecuting Authority. So we're just monitoring that from a national perspective to also be aware of the times when the cases would appear in court. Then our operational concept and the operational approach from SAPS is based in the following principles: that police will maintain public order at all times, that POPS units are mobilized across the country with deployments to hotspots. Members are clearly instructed to utilize established crowd control methodologies against protesting students with the recognition of constitutional right to strike. The concept of minimum force is strongly emphasized. Flexibility and discretion within the law to be utilized by commanders. No sharp ammunition to be utilized. Prefer options to monitor the peaceful actions by students and channel them accordingly, and we're tasking the protection of life and property. Then the public order policing resources are constantly reviewed, and then additional deployments is on standby to be mobilized to hotspots where there would be such a requirement. The way forward, Chairperson, is that the NADJOC and the PROFJOC are closely monitoring all hotspots. We do pre-deployment based on information and intelligence. There is close cooperation in the meetings with the Departments of Basic as well as Higher Education. The monitoring of the national key points, contingency planning that's in place for any gatherings, and then the increased capacity and gathering capabilities from the Intelligence Coordinating Committee, and then DCIS, its communication with key messages that they portray. The person and honorable members, thank you for your time.
Thank you, General, and thank you, Acting National Commissioner. We will take a 15-minute tea break, 50 minutes, and then we'll come back for questions and engagement. Thank you.
Hello.
And that's the end. And we have the tea break, so still possible.
Still
possible, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, but if anything changes, I'll let you know.
Members, 1 minute.
Thank you, all members and the delegations. Maybe just to indicate, it seems budget cuts is now very prevalent. I didn't even get these, so yeah, that's how it is. So apologies if any one of the delegations has been affected. But water will also assist us going forward. Right, honourable members, we will now go to questions from the honourable members. Honourable Malabasi, and then we'll go down and
thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe before I pose my question to register our happiness and to say we are very grateful to SAF in the manner in which you handled this hashtag #SheSmartFall and hashtag #MaximumRestraint. To say we are really very proud of you. you really manage to avert maybe another marijuana of some kind, we are really very, very, very grateful. But we do have questions. My first question goes to Ajit. Are you able to pick if there was provocation before an incident happened? And how do you deal with this issue of trade-ins? What the trade-ins, how do you deal with it? My next question is to Sat. Whilst we applaud you, the role of criminal intelligence in this whole thing.
Maybe crime intelligence.
I mean crime intelligence. Yeah, I'm sorry. The crime intelligence is questionable, very, very questionable. For instance, here in Parliament, it was like you just woke up and this whole thing happened. We had a meeting in May, and we had been. You could see those numbers were swelling at the gate, but your preparation was not up to the standard. My question is, what role of your intelligence? Can I go on, sir?
Let's take this back for a second now. Hold on a moment.
Thank you, sir. Two questions. I think I'm covered by the question Honorable was. Two questions, Chair. Maybe it's a question and recommendation to the ex-National Commissioner. I'm not sure, Chair, but I think maybe the hashtag gender inequality must fall. Looking at the delegation, it represents the old order, male only. So I think we have to get an answer from that. The second question, Chair, is that now we learned that there is no respect to national key points by professors. What is your future plan, you know, to protect all those national key points? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Mula.
Thank you, Chairperson. At first, I want to thank SARS for your role that you played in this hashtag Feed My Voice. Thank you very much. My question is in slide 4 and 6, I think. In your presentation, you said 17 cases were brought to the attention of IGP for investigation. But in my presentation, it says 16. So can you please give us clarity? I don't know which is 17 or 16. I don't know. In slide 20, for the third, what are the charges of 6 arrests made within parliamentary precinct? And 23 arrests, is the charges the same or not? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Kone.
No, thank you, Honourable Chair, also that I follow my colleague has spoke before me that in the face of high provocation, a charge provocation that the hashtag maximum restraint word. I think the police have handled the matter professionally. I think we must register that in face of all what was happening. Chair, only the just quick on the other small question. If the WEN case, when you conclude your presentation, you mentioned that you will investigate to complete this matter. But you don't tell us exactly your time frame, when are you going to finish it. And two, then just for the purpose of the reader, of your when you say discharge of the official fire, when I'm sitting here as a layperson, when you say the charge of the official firearm, I can only imagine that that is the handgun that has been discharged. But in your explanation, you did mention that it is a lethal grenade. Maybe in your writing, as you think about it, for us to be able to follow it properly, you would just have to explain it that way. So that on the police side, I go back to the slide number 10. And I wrote here as I was reading this last night, so why are you telling us this? This is a question I wrote. I said, when you were telling about the poor access control car, all this, I asked the question, why is the police telling us all this? As if they don't have the abilities and the power to do something about it. Now I see the letter that was written in 2012 and starting from 2004. So it goes on 2012, today is 2015. Now, the question is still the same. Why are you telling all us this instead of doing something as an authority of state that has a responsibility on the safe side? I mean, it can't go on for 5-10 years just because the refuge of management will be a letter dated 2012. Something must happen. That doesn't mean that the DG to the commissioner or the general do not engage in a structural way. You did mention that the structure is not working. It's not effective, it's not operational. But general, is it good enough? Is it really good enough just to explain it in a simple letter and not national action, doing something to fix the problem? And I'm not arguing here that we want to build Parliament as a fortress. It's not that simple security breaches and lapses that are simple. Surely, this is a thing of courage to do something about it. So that's why I wrote, why are you telling us all these problems? Instead of saying action in resolving this is X, Y, Z. Surely, Chair, the issue about the public works and the failure of public works is a matter that we'll have to take differently. But can we now be assured that something is going to be done? On a simple thing that you have highlighted as a business within the authority. Now, the third thing, General, which is my work, we can't fly blind. Police can't fly blind. You didn't show us that picture, and the presenter said, well, the small group broke into small groups and they attacked or they moved into a different direction simultaneously. It suggests that there was some degree of planning, because that can't happen without necessarily planning for it to happen. So the question I certainly ask myself as a layperson, why don't you know about it? Is it ability, is it a problem of footprint to understand what is happening? Because surely there's some degree of way in which that has to be known and is neutralized before it happens. So it came reactive, which means we are almost like flying blind. You can't fly blind with the kind of capacity that you have. So maybe fast forward. What is it that you are doing to correct that? And I'm not suggesting that you're going to tell us all the details here, but I'm pointing out to a lapse, a serious, very serious weakness. And I don't want to say this may stretch beyond yourself, because it may not just simply be end of your current intelligence issues. It might include others. But if this
what demonstrates the inability for us to be able to understand the issues as they depend, then we have a problem. So I think it call on you, General, and others to really get back into the mode of understanding what is happening and be able to put structures in place to understand that. So what is it that we're going to do around that? And because there are many other things, but for me, key things is how do we then prevent this tomorrow? We all know that the student has said nationwide that we are playing for the matter of all matches after the exams. They're telling us through their social media what they're going to happen, what's going to happen. So we have to plan before it actually happens. So it means that these things that we're talking about, and Parliament is one of those areas in terms of the 1.2 meter fencing and other stuff that can be done. And of course the capacity and the mobility of deployment in terms of when this happening that they're able to deploy in time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Martin. Yeah, now I'll go first this line and then Honourable Martin and Honourable Bailey.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just want to clarify myself. In terms of the national key points, I don't know how those are declared, but according to me, it's a funny arrangement whereby if the president is not part of the national key point, but only buildings within the president itself, I just want to understand the use of maximum force by the police. That would be done, and the explanation would be that if their lives are threatened, then they can use maximum force. Then the question would be, in terms of a building as a national key point, when do you have to use maximum force? Are you to prevent the person from getting into that building? And if a person is trying to force himself or herself into that building, can you then use maximum force? Which means shooting, maybe, or what happens under such circumstances. And that would go along with a situation where we say the police restrain themselves. That's a relative term. If somebody is throwing a brick at me, how should I respond? If I respond forcefully, would that be self-defense? Or what happens? But the main question here would be, if a person is violating a national key point, then what do you do? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I want to start by saying, you know, politics is really interesting. I have here a news bulletin, and it says the ANC, the African National Congress, and the Democratic Alliance both condemned the police's heavy hand to quell a student protest in the parliamentary precinct on Wednesday. So the police was criticized, and I think it was unfair. I want to say to the South African police services, they did a well and a good job on that day. What can we expect from the police members? When it shoots us as politicians, we want to criticize them. Because it may be popular to do so. That's not fair towards South African police services. And that's why I here also said in Parliament, next time, maybe we should open the gates. Let the people come into the parliament. and see if we will be satisfied. It's the same with all the problems that has been revealed the other day. A letter more than a year ago to Public Works Department. And chairperson, we must be fair. It is not the job of the South African Police Services to create these buildings and put up fences and everything. It's not the job. When it suits us as politicians, we say there must be a clear line between the separation of powers in a democracy. But when it suits us, then we want the police to interfere with that. So I want to appeal this morning, or this afternoon, maybe, to say to members of Parliament that we must be fair. Yes, we will criticize. But I want to congratulate the police and say, General, to you and all your members, you did the job well done. Yes, of course, there were certain problems. And maybe, Chairperson, I must also, maybe General Annandale must just explain to the
questions.
Chairperson, I will take half the time of Honourable Ramachandran. Don't push me. You're not fair then. Right. No. I find it. I will take all the time. Maybe we might get an explanation of a shock grenade. Because some people have an incorrect perception of what it really is. The sound is more than the bite of it. Because the moment you start to talk about shock grenades, everybody's going, is that possible? Because in their minds, they have a grenade. Jefferson, to come to the questions. On the letter addressed to Public Works, was there a follow-up letter to that? And I think that we as committee should get Public Works here to come and explain why didn't they act on this letter. My second question, Jefferson. As far as crime intelligence and even national intelligence is concerned, did police services determine who is and was behind this whole issue? Because I am not convinced that it was a student who started the hashtag and then this spontaneous situation we had. I don't believe it. Who paid for the buses for the students to get to the places where they protested? So my question is, from an intelligence point of view, who sits behind all the protests? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Daly. Thanks very much, Chairperson. Am I correct? It's two questions per round. Yeah, okay, thank you. So I think just very short remarks to start off with is, I think it's very good that we've got the clarity that technically there was in fact no breach of the national key points, because that's how it had been framed in much of the coverage, and that the police action in responding on 21st in Parliament was rather in reaction to the unauthorized entry of the precincts. So I think that was very good clarity for us to get. And Chair, I just want to outline very quickly to say that for me there are two things here. On the one hand, there is the clear mandate that the public order policing units have. Nobody is disputing that. The other aspect, which is where my questions and my concerns and my criticism comes in, is about the case-by-case application of degrees of force and whether or not those were proportionate and appropriate in different circumstances. So nobody is saying the staff should not have acted or should not act in a situation requiring crowd management. It's the how and the underlying approach that raises the questions. And that's why, Jefferson, I did write to you, which resulted in the hearing, is that to me it betrayed at least strands of a militaristic, securocratic approach to what I would just call civic mobilization. Unfortunately, strand of that thinking did come through in some comments we heard today. The acting commissioner made a remark about how the SAS acted when the country was under siege. You know, under siege. You know, only enemies hold you under siege.
not citizens exercising their rights. And of course there was we can't talk about any effects having been facing national key points, because we're talking about students here, we're talking about parliamentaries, you know, 4 minutes of US parliaments. So this militaristic mindset for me is highly problematic, and the fact that to carry out their mandates in terms of crowd management and public order policing in very different ways, with different underpinnings. And with that, I'm going to pose my first question, Chairperson. In terms of compliance with the regulations and the prescripts that are in place for these situations, I've been looking at the 2012 National Instruction on Public Order Policing, and the Acting Commissioner Matthias didn't know if there is an update to these. But the information I have on hand, I'm just going to make reference to two sessions on which my questions are based. The first one is session 13. Section 13 of this National Instruction speaks to the management of these crowd management operations, and it does encourage that these must happen peacefully, or there must be peaceful crowd control. So 13.1b, for example, says that no operation should be conducted without a reserve, which may be a section between company or group, to provide the operator commander with options. And that's the first question I have, is was there a reserve to the public order policing contingency that was stationed at Parliament? Because the most effective way that crowd management happens is through numbers. The operational officers need to have numbers to, when they have those push tactics that were made reference to, they're actually effective, and they can't be pushed back by the crowd. I mean, I think a classic example was during the Wildcats miners strikes in the mid 80s in the UK, which got very violent. But to my knowledge, those police officers in the UK never had to use equipment like stun grenades and that sort of thing, because they just had the numbers to contain and to push back when needed. And if, when you don't have kind of provisions like reserves, as the national instruction says, that officers can feel overwhelmed, they get panicky, and then we jump straight to other measures that our contains are in fact disproportionate. So that's a one sub question. Was there a reserve? Was the public order policing contingent at Parliament in a position to swell their numbers if needed, so that it could contain and act without deploying measures like pepper spray and the stamp grenades? Because that's where people start to get a bit pitchy. There's nothing wrong with managing crowds, but it's how you do it, it's the approach and it's the mindset that underpins that. And then on section 14, which I think is really comes down to the core, because it talks about executing those public order restoration operations, is section 14.2, subsections 2 and 3, and it speaks to if negotiations fail. And I did hear that there were attempts to negotiate, but there was no clear leadership, so it's understandable that there might have been some ambiguity there. But these really only kick in if life or property are in danger. And I'm not quite convinced that we had reached that critical level yet. And subsequently says, if the use of force is unavoidable, any offensive actions taken must de-escalate the conflicts with the minimum force. So my second question, sub-question linked to this is, were we at a point of conflict when that clearing operation happened? Because the information I have, I was a witness to it, but the information I have is that when the students reached within 5 meters of the National Assembly building, they sat down. So if they sat down, I'm not sure what the conflict was at any point that required de-escalation through the deployment of the stun grenades and pepper spray at the best occasions. And then, Chairperson, my second question, as a separate issue entirely, is referring to slide 20 about the six students who were arrested on precincts, what became known as the Belleville Six. And there's a very important question to ask around this, which is that we know because the photos were taken and were posted on social media, that initially these six individuals were charged by the courts on three charges, one of which was high treason. Now, that high treason charge was withdrawn, but it still begs the question of how on earth do we, in the very first place, arrive at a place where we charge protesting students with high treason. Again, it betrays that militaristic, securocratic mindset that as soon as there's this kind of civic mobilization or demonstration, go straight to a security approach and we arrive at that highly escalated point of being willing or considering charging people with high treason. High treason. So I need an explanation around that. I'm happy that there was a backtrack from that, so no charges were withdrawn. But you know, what was being thought when it was considered to charge them with high treason? And the information I have when I spoke to one of the lawyers was that apparently there was an instruction from on high to make an example, which in itself is very worrying. That's your question.
Thank you, Honorable Evans.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's fair to say from the outset that the DA unequivocally condemns criminal activity, destruction of property, assault, any of those things. It's not as if you know you're going to sit here and try and legitimize what the students have done. So any violation of the law should be condemned. But we also condemn the excessive use of force by the police. Not the police actions. We do not question the need for the police to have acted, but what we condemn was the perception or the footage or the indication that was created that the police had used disproportionate excessive force preemptively. And the reason for this is because all of this would have been prevented, in my opinion. The entire situation escalated because of a number of failures in the run-up to so-called storming of the Bastille. In the first instance, again, the police were the first responders on a scene when the people that should have showed up should have been the Minister of Higher Education and the Minister of Finance, as requested by the students. And unfortunately, they were met by an executive arm of the state that deals with enforcement and not necessarily negotiating with their concerns. Secondly, we know what the troubles are within the Division of Crime Intelligence. There is, for me, a clear failure on the part of crime intelligence to adequately respond to this, detect it, and to deal with it. The entire hashtag Seize My Phone movement across the country has been an organic response facilitated by social media, which made it easy to mobilize. We saw on Twitter that NGOs are involved with legal assistance, with providing provisions for the students, and I think it's unfair to pretend or to create the impression that there's some ring leader behind this that is funding it, because that's exactly what the ANC has been trying to do, to pretend that they've been funded by English sources or other people trying to destabilize the state. And I think we must understand, because it is an organic movement, it becomes very difficult, and I can empathize with the police, because it's difficult to negotiate or to defuse a threat if there are no clear leaders. And I get that completely. But I spent a lot of time among the students between 12 and 2 o'clock.
Member, just question. I appreciate the speeches, the many interpellations. I know that, but let's
do it. It's a question about crime intelligence. Why was the proper threat assessment done? If yes, what did it indicate? Because when I spoke to the police officer outside, I asked him, so what do you make of the claims on social media that they're going to storm Parliament? And the officer just listed and said they're unlikely to happen. They have no reason to believe it. They're gathering peacefully. And it was reflected in the lack of numbers of police in the precinct on the day. And it's equally revolting for me to hear that there wasn't even a meeting convened of the JPC to discuss this. Clearly, it's a failure of crime intelligence. And a specific question, who was the commanding officer in charge of the deployment here at the police at on the day? Because I think I have a suspicion of who it was, and that a similar incident happened in February, and it deals with an inconsistent application of the law. The Regulation of Gatherings Act defines a zone around Parliament from Queen Victoria Street down that way to this way in which gatherings are prohibited from taking place without permission from the Chief Magistrate of Cape Town. And when I was arrested in February at the State of the Nation event, that was the reason given for it, that we sit on the side of Addy Street. So why is this not consistently being implemented? Because yes, there are three national key point buildings on the precinct, but this entire precinct, as well as surrounding property, and the same key buildings are designated in this legislation as though gathering zones. And I'll have the other questions, Chairperson, in the next round, but I also just want to request a similar breakdown of the events at the union buildings as we saw on page 21 for Parliament, and also a breakdown of the charges for the cases open on page 33 if possible. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honourable Trumbi.
Honourable
Robert Garner, yes.
Chair, I just want to just make this request. I know it's an easy language issue, that we're dealing with a matter that does not require this point fingering, politicking, cheap politicking. I've listened to the issue raised by the previous speaker, and I'm listening to you what the AEC did and what I think we should refrain from this easy things to do. There's even the issue that has been raised, Honourable, and I think Honourable Kuhnabart and Honourable Holness, you are raising it. That's all I want to say, because you can do it. It's easy to do it, and you're not going to achieve much.
Chairperson, point of order.
Yes, Honourable.
Chairperson, we are members of Parliament, and I will not be restricted by anybody on what I want to say and what I already said. Let it be clear.
I think, let's try and settle this point. I think the tradition in this committee is we stick to the main business, we try to depoliticize issues, we try to deal with the merits. Let's continue with that tradition. Because if we're going to go to the other approach, it's not going to be productive, we're not going to get consensus. So members, please, let's remember. Honourable Song.
I am here representing a political party, elected to represent the views of that political party. And I'm not using this as an opportunity to attack ANC. What I simply did was, as Honourable Funabob did when he mentioned what the EFD was tabling a fact. And it illustrated, in my mind, a failure of responding to this, and that's all I did. So I'm not reducing it to politics. Yes, I'm here to represent a political party, but the facts are out there, and the Honourable Member is more than welcome to challenge that. Thank you.
Honourable Mulubatsi.
This is getting out of hand to all us representing political parties. We all are. But the tradition of this committee is when they a national issue of national importance, we come together into that. If we don't do politics, let us stick to that. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Martin, the same as I want to move forward. Yes.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I understand that anybody can say anything that anybody wants. But what we are trying to do here is to get the answers from the police that are sitting there. If you have got problems with the ANC, the right place would be due to the house. They can't answer for the ANC. So it means we are wasting our time. They presented, and we are trying to solve a situation, which is not the ANC's situation. And we've got people in here who can answer to those questions. But instead, we take a detour to look for that. That's not going to help us. Thank you.
Because I'm not going to allow further discussion. Let's continue on this longer, because remember, we were supposed to deal with the private members' bill. That's now off the table, because members are busy with many speaks, but we'll allow it. But let's just continue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. First of all, Chairperson, I think it would be prudent for one to, under the light of the first presentation on that painful incident that happened, widely reported and circulated, over social media of that executive staff. However, the same day, I think that this committee, Chairperson, will be very much also prudent and wise that maybe 2 or 1 day after the break of such news, I was very much also shocked to find that I think it was in the moment, not mistaken, when two officers were on their patrol duty and were confronted by an armed man who bent, killing one officer and other officer getting badly injured. And that officer, you know, as I was listening to radio presentation this morning, that he was driving towards the health institution for help, you know. So it tells me that there is a bigger challenge that we're facing as a nation beyond just narrow accusations of this accusing that one. Because whilst we understand that, to ordinary young men and women on the ground, traumatized by these things almost on a daily basis, and also our people teaching, on the other hand, because of their antisemitism, we've got a serious serious challenge, which I think as a nation we will definitely have to rise on. But the chairperson is the correct. Here is not a platform whereby then we can begin to come on with the kind of political muscling and all that, because we ourselves, we shall be politicizing the police, whom we say needs to be outside of the political realm of things, but the professional in their conduct. So we will go to Parliament, we have got our own views. I do have my own views about this matter, even about our own collective failures as leaders, but we deal with them in the House correctly. So, now, but I just wanted first to raise that, to sympathize with men and women in blue, so that the U.S. leaders, they themselves, I know that family also, they are sitting there in cold situation. And if without Mr. Chairperson, as the responsible leaders of the country, public representatives, so to speak, cannot also pronounce on that, I think it won't actually do any help. It will affect the situation and let members be dependent in some extensive use of force. But as we actually talk to that, we are trying to say how to deal with this as a collective, from the side of the leadership and from the side of men and women in blue. So that is the thing. The only question then of the student protest, what I wanted to find out is just one. From the level of crime intelligence service, was there any pick-up of things? Because I know, for example, here in Parliament, I was there in Parliament on that day. Students are very peaceful, and I think your presentation does talk to that. When they came there and they sat nicely in Parliament and all that, and all hell broke loose afterwards there. But according to your crime intelligence, was there any hint of an external instigator, or you found students, as I saw them, to be just united in their diverse formations, political formations, confronting one issue? Better to that, because the discussion raised a very critical point, which I think it actually brings a lot of suggestions to my mind. Because police are found to be first responders in each and everything, which at times is outside of their scope. But because of maybe breach or break of the chain somewhere, then they have got a civil suit to actually then intervene in that situation. I want to know, if then there was any intelligence gathering that said, here we have got an external instigator of this, apart from the legitimate concerns that were raised by the students, was it picked up? Then lastly, looking at the swelling up of this, was there any proactive move from the side of civilians to carry of police? Well, I think it is actually the buffer between you as men and women in blue and as a political authority. leading the country. In terms of advice on the side and in terms of advice to the political leadership. I am raising, I'm tempted chairperson to raise it because the people that are going to build up to union building, they just started at the House. And I was a blessing of that. And even better mobilization of people from parties to join us this at the leadership level of the country and help problems on arrival in the zone. Now, I wonder, was there any move by civilian secretary to give such a kind of an advice on the side of police and also on the side of... Because at the end of the day, I don't really believe, it's not our belief from the side of the other police. On this matter, you can just begin to put finger pointing at other people. Because at the end of the day, we expect the police to draw only one line of saying, we are actually executing our official duties of protecting a sovereignty of the country and all that that belongs to it in a very professional and kind of manner. Then I believe personally that at the end of the day, police would have been left with no option whatsoever under the circumstances that are trying to figure out about. Because again, if you leave out the national security unattended, then you come to what the police do. Again, on our back, where are we? So that's why then I'm trying to strike a balance so that we can then be able to say, from the side of civilian secretariat, as people who are on the back, did they actually render any kind of an open advice to both yourself and also the political authority? Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Thank you, Honourable.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to be short because most of what I wanted to say has actually been covered by my colleagues. Safe to say that I also would like to express my disquiet on the role of the intelligence in this particular matter. I think if we are going to have the kind of intelligence that is reflected in these activities, then this country has a serious problem. Because in the report that we have presented now, we are given a current situation report, which is said to be coming from the intelligence community. But now we're dealing with a post situation. Where is the key situation report from the intelligence? We should actually have guided the deployment of the resources, including the manpower, to actually, guard against whatever eventuality that might actually be against the law. Where is that? If we have a viable intelligence, unit. Now, I have that problem. And the second one has to do with the deployment of the one cannot actually criticize it that much because in the absence of forewarning, how would you know what kind of resources and in what quantities do you need to deploy? You know, because to me, if I was a commander of commander here, I wouldn't know how many, what kind of resources and what sort of manpower I need to be able to contain the situation here if there was no intelligence. Forewarning. So I would like to know the issue of the manpower deployment, your response in terms of manpower on that day. And then the third one has to do with our future preparedness for such occurrences. What is our contingency plan? What have we learned from what has happened? And also be able to prepare ourselves. And the last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with, is actually related to Mr. Mackay's question. Parliament is defined as one of those key point areas, in the same way as our nuclear plants somewhere, Waterkloof, Air Force Base, you name them. I mean, what is your response, normally, in an event a key point area is attacked, whether by students or whether by a group of lunatics, or whether by mentally deranged people, whom you will actually only know about that once the incident has happened. How do you respond to that? Do you negotiate that such acts with those groups to say, look, please, this is a key point area, you may not adhere to this, please put down your key points and so on. Do you do that? What does the law say? What are you expected to do? And the last one is the balance. You see, when we first came here in 1994, we rightly declared this area as the People's Parliament. And what does that mean? It means that we were actually literally opening the gates of this particular area to our people, so that they would rejoice together with us triumphantly, celebrating the demise of apartheid. How then do you balance that with the stringent security regulations for a key area such as Harlem? Because the policy of this area being a People's Parliament has not been rescinded.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Two maybe technical issues from my side. I'm not going to give a speech. I think we must think, make a distinction between the incident at Parliament, the Union Movement, and of course the others around the country. But if you go to the annual report of SAPS, page 181, 182, where it deals with POP, there's the issue of the upgrading of equipment, and there's a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories. My evaluation of that day at Parliament, there were certain equipment lapses. For example, just to take one, maybe that's the post-operational issues, I think, acting National Commissioner, that the police will have to look at. For instance, the issue of communication in terms of loudspeakers. Two of the ministers wanted to address the students outside. There wasn't appropriate loudspeakers to deal with issues. It was insufficient. It was as so in terms of what you indicated in the annual report, does it speak to ensure that there's a necessary resource to the COPs in this country, and especially the one Parliament? Then on page 182 of the annual report, there was crowd management training for 854 POP members and 14 POP platoon commanders. If we might also, in the light of the incidents that happened, is there going to be an increase in that, and also maybe a change in the curricula? And then, a lot of the colleagues raised the issue of intelligence, but in terms of previous presentations, and it's in the annual report, a new POP information officials course was developed between POP and crime intelligence. So the question is, the course was developed, but was implemented. We heard from the, I think earlier this year, from the suspended National Commissioner, there would be crime intelligence officers with the POP units. It was confirmed, I think, in the move of a long oversight visit. So the question is that currently implemented on the ground and at Parliament? Right, let's go to the Acting National Commissioner, I think.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Our appreciation to the messages commending the work done by the South African policies during that difficult period, difficult and challenging period. I'll take a number of these questions and refer some to my colleagues who will deal with. Let's place it on record that we continuously raise internally an issue around intelligence, that intelligence should enable proactive policy, that we do not get caught up in reactive policy, because reactive policy is more expensive from all angles. So it is an area that we say to ourselves we need to prioritize and continuously review to check our effectiveness and efficiency in that regard. When it comes to what we were confronted with over the past two weeks or so, I must say that there was useful intelligence shared with us to enable the planning of the operations. We cannot say that it was adequate because many of those activities would have been unplanned. If you take, for example, the numbers that we had to deal with differed from what was given to us even by the organizers to say we are planning to march from point A to point B. When you look at the numbers, it's going to be so much, because this was not an issue that only affected students. It's an issue that also affected parents, people going in who were not necessarily coming from campus. If you look at the Pretoria march, we were given a number, I think we were expecting something like 12,000. We ended up dealing with 50,000. You would have given information on these are the number of buses that will be coming in from various places, and these buses, people will be converging at the point. Now, those buses do not arrive simultaneously. So even if your planning was you are expecting 12,000 people and you are going to marshal them from point A to point B in this manner, this is your deployment. That deployment on the day of the event get impacted by the inefficiency on the part of the organizers. If you are expecting 50 buses and 30 buses arrive, you still have information of late departures from other places. That is forcing you to be able to kind of split your resources, which must enable the policing of the groups that will be coming in much later. So we can't attribute what we would have been confronted with solely to lack of intelligence. We had intelligence. It enabled us to plan. It enabled us to deploy. But the situation on the day would have dictated otherwise. But that said, will not be an excuse to say we have got an efficient and effective intelligence machinery. It is agreement on our part to say if there is one area that we need to look at, and we'll continue to do that, is our intelligence to make proactive policing a reality. And maybe just before I step off there, it was not only our crime intelligence that was coming to the party in this regard. The state security in intelligence, they continued feeding us with information. And that information helped us, you know, to verify what we would have received from one source to say, this indeed is going to be happening. So, from where we are sitting, how we manage it, we are satisfied that with what was at our disposal, we were able to manage the situation. But there will be room for improvement, and we welcome the honorable members' inputs, particularly in flagging the area of intelligence, which will remain a priority to us. Honorable Chair, I should actually have started with this for gender inequality. I am admitting that this is a male-dominated delegation, but this is in no way a reflection on the gender picture within the department. I guess, Chair, just like we were confronted with cost containment measures on food earlier, this is a cost containment issue to say who are those key people that I will require to be able to respond to the issues at hand. And this will be colleagues who in one way or another would have taken a lead in managing the situation that we were confronted with. But we are sensitive to that. Just on a lighter note, we ended these 2 weeks of marches with a march by the ANC Women's League to the union buildings. And our directive to General Mutiva and the colleagues was, I would want to see that march managed by women. And indeed, the deployment of the team that managed that march was more women, because we believe in their abilities. We believe that they are competent to be able to handle situations of that nature. And here we are. We had an incident-free march which took place on Friday. So, yes, the equity issue, the gender issues will remain sensitive to that, and as and when the situation permits, we will broaden the scope of this group to bring in our competent colleagues, women, to be here. Chair, what is the future plan to protect in respect of the fish must fall? We have accepted that it did not go away. We have accepted that it is going to come back. Intelligence suggests so, towards the end of January, towards somewhere in February, it is going to be an issue. And without disclosing much, we are on the ground, and we will use lessons learned from the recent incidents in ensuring that there is proper planning, which will prevent poor performance. We cannot consider it to be history. It's something that is going to be with us. And I appreciate when you started earlier, you said, we are the first responders. And unfortunately, we come in when conflict has escalated in the boardroom somewhere. People will not have continuously kept us posted officially to say this situation is now escalating to that level. So in the main, we come in when the emotions are high and they explain in to say we are now going to march and so on and so on. Now, nowhere in that march, in the planning of the march or in protest action, will they say part of what we are going to do is going to ban vehicles, destroy that and that. It so happens spontaneously. Now, Honorable Chair, if that happens, we are forced to take action. The constitution of this council provides for a policing organization with clear functions enshrined in Section 205. Now, we will execute our mandate as per the Constitution while we respect the rights which are in the Constitution to protest, you know, to march, for people to raise their issue. The Constitution never said that we must be violent either in marching or raising issues. It's supposed to be peaceful. But unfortunately, the situation on the ground escalates to that level where we are left with no option but to exercise our powers. And we're grateful that in this regard, we have exercised restraint. If there was force, which some define it as being brutal force, it would have been proportional. That is why today we don't talk about any casualties. If you look at the number of people that we said were injured, those that were reported, there were about 17 students, there were 13 members. Now, the number of students or number of those that were protesting far outweigh the number of police people on the ground. But you talk about 17 on the part of students, 13 on our part. Honorable Chair, those who know the union buildings will know that it's beautiful gardens which were displayed there. And there are no stones there. But you would have seen in the picture that was put before you the number of stones and bricks that were pelted at the police. Surely someone came carrying those stones from somewhere. And those stones were directed at our members. It was provocation to the extreme. Now, sir, if that is what we are confronted with, it cannot be that when we say we were under siege, it's something that is foreign. Maybe there is a dictionary meaning of under siege, but I in no way don't understand it to be saying under siege has got a military connotation to it. It's an attack. It's an assault that, you know, was waged. And we did not at all respond in a manner that you would have said it is a military response. Application of proportional force is what happened. Minimum force. And I have said our approach would have been characterized by hashtag maximum restraint. And for that, I think we need to continue to applaud our members, to continue to make them aware that it is possible that you can deliver these results without having to go to the extreme where we even start talking of live ammunition and so on, because that is disaster. The moment you get there, it's disaster. So we were able to contain that situation. So if the usage of the way would have created the impression that there is this military response. No, it was not intended to suggest so. Honorable Chair, what are the charges for the arrested? And I'm glad this question is being asked, because far too many people were on this bandwagon of high treason. There is not a single person who was charged with high treason. And I refer to the Bevel 6, if that's what we're referring to them, they were not charged with high treason. If they were charged with high treason, they would still be behind bars today. What happened, and it's so unfortunate that, you know, internal processes get used to have selfish agenda somewhere. People were arrested in the heat of the moment. There was destruction to property. There was, which culminates into malicious damage to property. Once there is property destroyed, malicious damage to property charges will be preferred. In this case, and I know this thing was circulating on social media to say there is proof that they were charged. It was a notice when the people were detained because at that time you had not concluded the investigation. So an investigation was still going to be carried out, but you have arrested these people. So a notice would have been served to them as, I think we call it, what, 14A? 14A, which will say there are three things that you may be charged with. One of which is public violence. Secondly, it is trespassing. Thirdly, it is high treason. You may be charged because an investigation will have to be conducted, which will reveal what is it that these people are being charged with. Honorable Chair, honorable members, there is no single individual who has been charged with high treason. And if that continues to circulate, it is saving whoever's agenda I don't belong. And that's why those people were released, I think the following day after they were detained. So in short, I'm not going to say the this and those in Pretoria, but the charges that would have been, people would have been charged with was public violence, trespassing particularly here. We have malicious damage to property. We have shown here vehicles that were touched and so on and so on. So that will account for the trespassing charges that are there. Honorable Matlakane asked the issue on why the issues on slide 10. Oh, he's not here. But, Chair, we have an obligation to be very transparent to honorable members of what the issues are that we are confronted with. And it is not necessarily to say we are not doing anything about those which we have flagged. We are just saying the situation we find ourselves in dictates as follows. And we may not have said what else are we doing, but if one refers to the letter that we are shown that was directed to the Department of Public Works, it was taking on board some of the issues that we would have flagged in slide 10 to say these are the things that need to be attended to. Of course, this is not a matter that can only be dealt with through letters. It's a matter that requires engagement with our counterparts in the Department of Public Works and so on. And now that we are over this period, which our focus was on what was happening in the streets, we will be allowed space to consolidate some of these issues and be able to take them to the authorities where we must seek some resolution. So there is assurance from our part that something will be done, and part of that is going to be engaging those that are responsible, those that should come to the party to assist us in this regard. Yes, Chair, police cannot fly blind, as Honorable Madhavan Ramakagan said. A question was asked about ability, footprint, neutralizing the situation, structures to respond. Now, reality dictates that when a march or an action like this one in Parliament was planned, some people will opt not to come to that central point. So, our capacity cannot only be focused in this one area. We still have to make sure that there is deployment in those institutions so that those that are left behind do not take advantage of the focus here and do what is wrong and cause much more damage on the other side. So this goes back to the question of intelligence and was there intelligence to inform what was going to happen. After the Parliament March, was it the 21st? We continued to receive intelligence that they are coming again. And thus did leave the institutions to come to Parliament. But while they were on their way, they changed their plans. For example, I think it was the Peninsula and the Belleville where we had buses coming. But because they did not have enough support, they then changed their plans en route to go to an institution here in Cape Town. So that's things that will not be, we will not have full control thereof, because the intelligence will have to deploy at Parliament, which we did. But en route it changes, so you need to redirect the resources to be able to take care of that situation. Situation there. So, Chair, I'm in no way going to suggest that we have got more than what we require to respond to each and every situation. But I think we can reasonably say that we have a capacity to deal with any eventuality. I'll give an example, Chair. In the Eastern Cape, in Grahamstown, the focus was on the institution. And knowing that the focus is on the institution, out of nowhere, they went into the shops owned by foreign nationals. I think that one evening, they went something like 50 shops of the foreign nationals. We ended up arresting 85 people in that particular incident. So, It's a catch-22 situation that we find ourselves in, that we always have to manage when we are confronted with such. So just going to some of the issues that have been raised. The use of maximum force. Honorable Chair, I'm glad that there are no fatalities. But as to whether our response on the day was adequate, I'll ask my colleagues, particularly General Mawela, from public order policing perspective, and General Kwena, to talk about the response when it comes to the national key points. The question, did the sub determine who was or is behind the student protest? Surely it could not have been the students on their own. If you take a bad situation, students were saying we want to go back. But then they went, a group was now riding on the back of cleaners and the outsourced services. And because the fees must fall issue was losing momentum among the students, they now wanted to escalate to a different level. So while I'm not going to give the details of who is behind it, it is subject of further investigation to try and get to the bottom of it so that we are not confronted with situations of that nature. It is true. If you look here, what happened on the 21st, people took advantage of the situation. T-shirts were being dished out left, right, and center. Now, those T-shirts were not coming from the students themselves. So, it is clear that it will not have been just fish must fall issue. In the union buildings, or the morning before the majority of the students converged, we saw people there whose identity was very questionable. We are following them in terms of what was the agenda, what is their role in respect of this. If you go back to the union buildings again, the meeting had convened. The president has already pronounced following the engagement with the leaders. But still, after his announcement, it is, we want the president to come. Now, what is it that the president must go and say? If he had a meeting with the leadership, he already made a public statement to say 0%. But then we are being pelted with stones and everything else to say he must come. How do we allow a state president to come into that volatile situation? It's a security assessment that you do and say it is not safe. And therefore we are not going to take any risks. We brought the leadership of the students who were to say this is the position. The same leadership was pelted with those. They had to run for cover. Now, was it really a fish or small issue? One day we will answer that question. Honorable Chair? No, Honorable Member, it won't take too long because it will be part and parcel of the investigation that we are busy with. Case-by-case application of the use of force, was it professional? Definitely yes. I was there at the union buildings, and I was here on the day I was arriving. I could not enter the precinct. I saw the honorable member somewhere in the corner there, and it was, this cannot be allowed. This cannot be allowed, what happened here. I'm so grateful to the members for having pushed them back outside, to go outside, and I will repeat myself many times, Chair, no loss of life in that process. It was a responsible thing to do, just to say, we respect your right to protest, but we cannot allow anarchy at all. Honorable member said that this is the People's Parliament. It doesn't change. It remains the People's Parliament. But I guess when we converge in a People's Parliament, there should be order. Now, I don't know if we will be sitting here today with the honorable members saying we have done okay if we have left the students to invade the chambers. I think it would have been worse. It would have been anywhere else in the media. And we had to avoid that at all costs. The situation was managed and we did not have any casualties out of there. I don't agree, Honorable Chair, with the notion that there was a militaristic approach. Somewhere the police must be allowed to do their work as provided for in the Constitution. They must be allowed to apply the laws of this country. And it cannot be that we only act when lives have been lost. It cannot be. And we have no reason to say that we have police. I agree with the notion that there should be proactiveness. We must stand, and I think Honorable Chair and Honorable Members know very well, that the bulk of our budget is in Program 2, Visible Policy. Why? Because if you can prevent crime, if you can prevent a situation from escalating, you would have done wonders. Now, we will resolve to make that proactive policy a reality. But where the situation has escalated to a level where we must be reactive, we will apply the laws of our country accordingly. And if one of those laws suggests that there should be proportional use of force, we shall do so. To bring peace and stability, and to make sure that the people of this country are safe and feel safe. Honorable Mbene raised a question about national instruction, public order. At this stage, I'm not so competent to deal with that. The national instruction can ask me more about forensic services. I'll ask the colleagues to go and respond to the details of the national instruction. It is still early days here. Slide 20, I've dealt with it. They arrested, the six arrested, the high trading, and also this, Honorable Chair, I don't take this one kindly, instruction from above. No. The National Commission of the Police directs police people on the ground in accordance with the Constitution to execute their policing mandate. Maybe that above is at this level. But at this level, what the instruction that came across to all levels is that you apply maximum restraint. No other instruction came from anywhere else. That above will be at this level, nothing higher. And we allow the people on the ground to assess the situation and act accordingly. And Honorable Chair, we are grateful that that action was not irresponsible at all. Finite crime intelligence, I think I've dealt with the issue. It may not be necessary to go too much into detail. I take the honorable members' content in this regard, which as part of the review, we will go into it between today and, what is today, Wednesday? Between today and Friday, they are in a strategic session, the crime intelligence colleagues, I need to see them. And of course, one of those issues that I would want to talk to is us having to up our game so that we allow the police people on the ground to function effectively and efficiently, to be proactive in a way. So thanks for raising this issue. I know that it may not satisfy all of us to say we are going to, but it's a situation that requires much more attention. Just like we have resolved that we want to focus ourselves and turn the picture around in as far as the cases are concerned, this is another area that interests us. I'll allow General Mawela to talk to General Mawela and General Kabichile to talk to who was the commander on the day. They will come back to that. Breakdown of charges in the union buildings, primarily in the union buildings, it was public violence as well as damaged property. The issue of was there any outside force, I'll have spoken to it earlier, it's a question that repeats itself. Similarly to the intelligence, I have dealt with the deployment, manpower deployment, and maybe the question, what was learned. Of course, one of those is that we must be proper planning to prevent poor performance. We must be proactive in the main. We must do deployment much earlier. We must have information on our fingertips. Intelligence is very critical. But some of these will be taken going forward. Let me pause here, sir, and allow the colleagues to deal with some of those issues that I will not have covered. The one is who was the commander. There was the other one, the national instruction, which still had to be dealt with. And while they are dealing with that, I will check which others did we not cover. There was an issue on that the Honourable Chair raised in respect of the that is in the annual report, page 181 and 182, in as far as equipment is concerned. Just for the Honourable Chair's information, it is an issue that I was also raising with the colleagues to say, are we utilising what we are having? The issue of loud hailers is something that I was talking to say. You do not only require them at the end point, you require them as much as progressing so that you could be communicating with those that are participating, but also communicating or as an alternative with the members, because normally you will be talking to the members through the radio and so on. But it is important that that equipment is being utilized. Maybe between General Mawela, General Sipale, and General Kwena. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, General. Honorable Chair, honorable members, thank you very much for the opportunity. I will touch on the national discussion. The sessions referred to by honorable member that it is relevant for the planned gatherings, planned matches. Then the planning officers will be planned to put aside the reserve group. But when it is spontaneous gathering, it is difficult for you to can put the reserve group. Actually, the very same reserve group you have put aside for the plant one is the one which you move to where it is a spontaneous gathering. So, based on that, we are satisfied that the operational commanders on the ground, they did all their level best to can move the resources around to ensure that they deal with the situations as it unfolds on the ground. Again, the issue of this de-escalating and escalating of conflicts and whatever. So we normally leave it to the responsibility of the operational commander on the ground, because he will assess the situation and come up with what we call it the operational decision. If he or she on the ground feels it necessary that need to apply certain measures to can deal with the situation, he so do. Apply those measures. He will be, or she will be, in the position to can say to us, I did apply the following tactics because of the situation at that time. It warranted me to do or employ those tactics.
So it will be difficult at our level to say that at that point in time, this is what was happening, why he or she didn't act in this following manner. It will be difficult for us to get in with it at this level. Again, Honorable Chairperson, just to piggyback on the issue which was also raised around the maximum use of force vis-à-vis to protect national key points or buildings, destruction of buildings. Our policy says to us, the Bill of Rights is supreme. So if the Bill of Rights, it simply tells us that human life will be a priority for us. First things will protect human life, property it will come later on. So based on the threat which we are facing, surely if it is a student coming to the international viewpoint, life of those students will be a priority for us. We will ensure that we preserve life and then the property, it will be secondary. So we try to balance our operation based on that. Civil liberty and security. But what prevails, what is the priority for us, is a human life, right? It's a human life as it is enshrined in the Bill of Rights. General Gwena, if maybe you can also add.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. I think the Acting National Commissioner has also touched base on it. We're taking the two questions, when you use maximum force in the national key point, and what is your response when a national key point is attacked. General Morales also indicated it, that we are talking to the threat to life as well as property. I must also impress upon the committee that Section 3, subparagraph 1 of the National Key Point Act also makes provision that the owner of the national key point is also responsible to ensure the safety and security at that particular national key point. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Chair, Honorable Members. Question that I must respond to is who was the operational commander. There has been 11 levels of command on that day. I was overall commander. But technically, we had officers like Lieutenant Colonel Lucas. But I must also indicate that, Chair, within the other pair, we have just received that there is an investigation on this matter by police ombudsman. So we are saying we complied with the regulations, we have complied with what we were supposed to do in Parliament at that time. And I was overall operational command outside, but technical on the ground level. Here we had Lieutenant Colonel Lucas, but on the other premises, because the whole, most of the town was flooded with students on that day. Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Chair. I'm not sure if there is any which was not answered, but I thought that we covered the bulk. If we omitted, let's be reminded.
You want to come in? Yeah, because there was a question which was relating to the respect to national key points and the plan thereof. I think the important what we just need to mention is that the security and policing of national key points, yes, there's a plan, then integrated that is planned. Where PSS takes responsibility for protection and then ORS backs up, the local police station is also responsible for the policing of that particular that is national key point. But the whole process is intelligence led, which then includes that is the part of the intelligence. And I think the Acting National Commissioner has correctly answered the question on the People's Parliament, but important is that also all People's Parliaments in the world, they are governed by laws, which are the laws that are enforced. Thank you.
I think, Edie, is there any questions that you must respond to?
I think the first one that you said, in order to be able to pick if there was or were provocations before the incident happens, it will be very difficult because we
normally as the IP person, when a matter is reported in a protected docket, it's open itself, then is then reported to the IP. How do we deal with the issue in respect of the trade and the in respect of that, the victim use self-regular trade to disperse or to make the students to retreat, then alleging that he was assaulted by the police as and when he was doing that efforts, then the matter is also under investigation as the self-regular case of assault that was opened. The issue in respect of the different numbers, the 17 and 16 cases, the number, the exact number, the correct number is 17. I think there were two presentations that were sent to the portfolio committee, but possibly the content, the wrong one or the incorrect was to the honorable members, but the exact number with regards to the last presentation on the same date, it was 17 cases. Captured by the IPIT. In respect of the time frames there to conclude our investigations, normally we do it on or before 3 months. So within 3 months we will have finalized those parameters, but in respect of the preliminary investigations, we even do it within a day, within a week. The issue with regards to the discharge of official firearms, with regards to the quantification, as far as the regulatory matter is concerned, going forward, will indicate in brackets which type of the firearm was used by police officer in respect of that particular alleged incident, because just like the Honorable Dataram Fagan is saying, he's confusing, but he's just crafted as such in our IP text. But going forward, we'll try to elaborate more on the regulatory matter. That's it.
Thank you. I see a sea of hands, but I want to really restrict it, if it's really necessary, one question, no interpolations, because we're entering the 1 o'clock case. Yes, I'll allow this.
Thank you, Chairperson. But, Chair, in slide 4, when you add numbers, it says 15. Where is this one in this property? Thank you.
Mula, I just want to get an indication. Anybody in this row? The front page.
Thanks, Jefferson. I will confine my office to the law, specifically speak to the Regulations Gatherings Act. And I would like the delegations here to address the question of enforcement and procedure under Section 9 of the Regulations Gatherings Act. Because as I said, I believe that this could have been prevented if a number of other things had occurred. And the first thing that comes to mind in my thinking is, in terms of Section 9, once it becomes apparent to the commanding officer that the situation cannot be controlled, in other words, while they were still meeting outside, that he or she should get up and to inform them that they cannot control the situation, give them a notice of dispersal, give them within a certain timeline, that they say, now we are going to be forced to try to clear you out. How could it then, if this, because I'm not seeing, neither in union buildings and neither in parliament do I see that this actually, that Section 9 specifically was followed by the public order policing. And I would like to know whether this took place, if not, why not, and specifically, why did it not take place before they were allowed to even reach the precinct? Because clearly a written statement must have been done by the commanding officer, realized that the temperatures were flaring, and in that process, Section 9 should have been invoked. And related to that, at the union buildings, what led, because, I mean, it was an incredible awe at the extreme discipline that the police maintained at the union buildings. It was really, for me, having seen public order policing incidents go awry, I was very impressed by the discipline maintained by us, which looked to me too few officers to begin with. But what then happened that after the briefing had taken place, suddenly we saw Myala speeding around, there was then all hell broke loose, to use that word. How did that happen? Was there again a notice of dispersal? Was there a time frame given? How did that
especially on possible specific reference to section 9 of the regulation of the other side. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else either Colonel Bailey?
Thank you, Chair. Very quickly from my side is first to say thank you to the Acting Commissioner for clarifying that when he used the phrase about under siege, he was referring specifically to the unit buildings, because I do want to say that the situation in Parliament on the 21st and then at the unit buildings 2 days later were of different natures. So if he was referring to the situation at the unit buildings, then I understand that. My impression was that she was referring to the whole week and a half episode around the country with student demonstrations as being the country under siege, and that was very concerning from that perspective. And then to say, in terms of the response that we got in the last round about the fact that there was no reserve group for the Parliament incident, because it was unplanned and it was spontaneous, fair enough. That still speaks to, I think, a larger issue the chairperson has hinted at, is that there is a resourcing challenge that still needs to be speedily addressed, because even in instances of spontaneous and unplanned demonstrations or public unrest incidents, it's not an unfair expectation that the SATs can respond adequately to that. So that, again, because the key point for me is this: the police should never find themselves in a situation where they're overwhelmed and they get panicky, because that's when we end up Marikana, for example. It should be as much prevention as possible, so that you can manage things in a controlled, staggered way, and not find yourself having to lash out. So I think that chairperson is something we'll need to look at going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. The only two hands that I've seen is Oral Srinivas and Oral Ramadakane, and then close the list.
Thank you, Chair. I can ask for a question, but I heard what I heard. I'm satisfied.
Oral Ramadakane.
Well, Chair, I want just to say that in terms of the responses to questions, I think I'm satisfied that under the situation that the police were faced with, they have applied the regulation. In fact, they were the last maximum of restraint, and I'm happy with that. I think that the other issues that matter of my opinion and my colleague's opinion at this point doesn't take much to account, because I think what important issue that we have come across is to understand that particular aspect. I'm satisfied with that. Otherwise, if I were to venture into opinion, would not finish this meeting.
No, thank you very much. I don't know, is there anything finally from your acting national commissioner?
Honorable Chair, honorable members, no. Just to face on honorable Fiedling's comments, the act was applied to the matter in terms of the phases as the situation was unfolding on the ground. So we are satisfied, but I cannot say that it is not a matter that must not be reviewed. We will, of course, after these, have to go back and do some introspection, and this we do with the view of saying, if we were to be confronted with such, are we going to respond the same, or must we do some adjustment? And maybe the last one, Honourable Chair, on Honourable Mbele's comment on the reserve force, let me put it that way. When I was on that day in the province, I was made to understand by the provincial commissioner that we went to the extent of activating those that were normally on race days, you know, to try and complement, you know, our deployment. So it may be that in mobilizing them, some will get them quicker to a point, some not. But we are satisfied that we would manage the situation
is escalated to a different level. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, honourable members and various delegations. Honourable Acting ED, you anything to add?
Chairperson, I just wanted to clarify the follow-up from the honourable member there with regards to the slide 4, that the matter that was submitted there, it was a Hope X matter, which was supposed to have been added there to make 17, and that's the matter where I was indicating that it was death of Mr. A.M. Alam, with an IDTC number there, with the last number of 44451.
I thank you, members. Thank you, delegations, for today's interaction. I think it was important that we had the first interaction on the incident that happened in Gauteng. I think the proper procedures were followed by IFED investigating, and also we'll await the responses from the management of SAPS. We must ensure, of course, that at all times police act within the law, and that is the message that should go out. And we also welcome the comments made by the Acting National Commissioner this morning in that regard. With regard to the last interaction, again, I think from the committee side, maximum restraint in a constitutional democracy, critical. When dealing with protest, student protest, we must allow maximum space. And as we've also indicated, there's obligation on universities, technicons also to create situations where people can converse, where they can interact with these problems, the council, the vice chancellors, they should be the first responders, not the South African police. So they should play their role much more proactively. I think there's agreement. I think the minister has indicated in his task team that's going to be headed by the deputy minister. Crime intelligence is an issue that needs serious attention. From the committee side, we need fresh leadership there in that division. Going forward that we can deal with it effectively. The incident approach we absolutely agree, but the equipment issue, I think more work should be done, and maybe maybe next year, February, we'll have the action on that, but I think the equipment issue and technology, we're spending 2.1 billion rands, of course a lot of salaries, but 2.1 billion rands on public border policing. So we need to see the technology equipment coming through in also high-level events that we've seen here. Then I think also the issue of liaison, and maybe the issue of civilian secretariat comes into mind, but I think also from the police, in terms of community outreach, to ensure that institutions of high learning, there's good communication channels, there's good liaison, constant communication, to ensure that we can maybe also deal with any individualities to ensure that we move forward. So I think it's quite important. Certain lessons were learned, I think, in the process, but I think there should be action plans short of Parliament, union buildings, it's quite clear, and are under issues of adequate reserves, communication, all those issues, I think, Acting National Commissioner going forward is going to be vital for the committee, and we will, of course, monitor it. Members, we couldn't finish our program today, so on Friday we will have to start with Honourable Beres, private members' bill, and then we will deal with any of the other minutes and the other reports that we must approve. So if members, 9 o'clock, V5 on Friday morning, we'll appreciate it. I thank also the parliamentary legal advisor, that she will also have to come back on Friday for the private members' bill, but I mean, our time, unfortunately, the members at 45 minutes of straight questions, interpellations, and speeches. So thank you very much, members, for your contribution. We'll see again each other on Friday.